And we appreciate our all-volunteer staff, from our moderators in the chat room to our news ninjas to our blogger, our op-ed columnist, my head writer, David, in Tennessee. John Fox, who has just returned from a grueling week of gigs. And, of course, to Ben Birch, thanks. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks go out to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Learn about the work of the bravest people I know by going to CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today on the big program, Steve Hicks, president of ABSCOF, the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, going to be here talking about the budget cuts proposed by Governor Tom Corbett. Again, you look at these massive, just 30% massive cuts to higher education, massive cuts to education in general. The question then becomes, is this the moving away from public education? Is this the beginning of, well, the dividing line? The haves and have not going to be just basic education and the ability to get a further education. Is that where it's at now? Healthcare, I think, you know, for the most part, we lost that. Is education next? We will find out from Steve Hicks, also Ben Spett. He's going to be your organizing director for the Teamsters Local 728 in Atlanta. He's also the co-chair of Atlanta's Jobs with Justice on Senate Bill 469, or as I've been calling it, the Shaft Heartless Bill, because basically what they're trying to do down there is they're trying to do to the general population what they've done to workers. The fact of the matter is the God Hates Fags people can run around and boycott whoever they want and picket and protest and do whatever they want. But workers? No, can't do that. They want to bring that to the general public. So they're basically limiting your ability to say anything against your corporate masters. This is the end of the line here. This is them saying we finally got total control and you rabble. You unwashed masses, you the flock, just do what you're told. They're also there protesting the job losses at AT&T, some 740 jobs AT&T wants to move out of there. So we'll talk to him about that. Also in the second hour, Brandon Jessup, founder of Michigan Forward, going to be here talking about tomorrow's Michigan primary, but more importantly to talk about the dumping the little dictators they've got there ever since. I think it's Public Bill 4, ever since that came forward where they were allowed to put emergency managers in place who had the power to do whatever, set aside contracts, fire people, whatever. He had ultimate dictatorial powers. They're going to put it to a ballot vote. They needed 160,000 signatures. Right now, they claim to have 250,000. So if this gets on the ballot, this will be a good thing. Because as I understand, and I'm sure Brandon will be able to speak more to it, once they get it up, once it's now official, everything stops until it's decided. And that's a good little reprieve for the cities who are under these little dictators' control. So it'll be interesting to talk to him. And also in the third hour, Teresa Brown, United Steelworkers member, going to be here talking about the from Fargo to Findlay journey for justice with the Cooper Tire and Rubber workers and the American Crystal Sugar Company workers who have been locked out. Going to be here talking about that. As I understand it, Cooper Tire and Rubber, there's some movement. There may be an agreement. We'll also find out a little bit about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-RICK. 520-7425. Questions, comments, something on your mind. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I don't know if you saw this over the weekend. I've been not happy with this whole movement towards charter schools, towards privatization of education. This movement towards taking my tax dollar, handing it over to private corporations, and maybe they do some education while filling their pockets. Another example of exactly the fears that I have had down in Tampa, Florida. The Tampa Bay Times did an exclusive and a really a lengthy piece on this Life Force Arts and Technology Academy. I mean, who could be against that? Life Force Arts and Technology Academy. Who could be against it? Other than the fact that, as it's being reported, they held their first Christmas party since their reorganization and their reorganization with this other company in a Scientology church. Maybe there's just a little problem there. I can't imagine why parents would be upset with their children going into L. Ron Hubbard's place and, you know, being sold the Dianetics and being sold the Scientology. I can't imagine why you'd be upset if your kids were propagandized to. I just can't imagine. Kind of like I don't understand why anyone would be upset why, you know, put advertisements inside school buses. I don't know. It's you parents, parent people, just too protective of your little children, your little precious. Yeah, I guess I am. I am a little protective. But here, you look at this. This is another example, and I'm going to go through some of it, but it's just completely outrageous. They started this school because the idea is, well, we're going to teach art, and we're going to have computers, and they'll have access to Kindles and computers. Turns out there's like two computers at work in the entire place. It was going to be this alternative. It was going to be a great thing. It was going to be about arts. Well, turns out no art supplies. So they bring in, after they find out they're in deep trouble, they're $400,000 in hock. They find out they're in big trouble. So they fire their principal, who evidently they claim was stealing, and they bring in some other charlatan. This company called Art of Management, and they were there to help reorganize after the bankruptcy. And you know, the woman that's the head of this Dr. Hinan Islam, which you go, really? Is that your name? Was that given, or did you make that up? She's also the executive director of the World Literacy Crusade. Lots of amazing things about both of these groups. Understand, the World Literacy Crusade is a California-based group that promotes Scientology. We love their science study method. So, according to her, not pushing religion, but just the study of it. Now, you look at this. The state is giving this school $800,000 a year to educate these kids. So $800,000 of tax dollars going to this scam. And when you look at it, you find out the teachers' classrooms are horrible. The teachers are unpaid. Thousands and thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars going into her other business interests. And you go, well, the children must be doing well, right? No. In fact, of the last marking period, the one that said, oh, gee, are you succeeding or not? Four of the six categories, they failed completely. And now, understand, Florida has a very lenient, and I'm extremely lenient, way of measuring things. Evidently, two of the classes that they had passed their progress reports. 60% of the kids, I guess, if 60% pass, that is a success. And I'm going, 60%, really? That, to me, that was failure. 60 was, you're out the door. That's the end of it. No more. But here in Florida, I think evidently things are bad enough that 60% constitutes passage. 60%. Everybody else failed. So I look at this and I go, well, something good has to come of this, right? I mean, there's got to be something positive. No, nothing positive. In fact, the teachers who talk of, classrooms that don't have paper or pencils or textbooks, the computer lab that has two that work for the entire school, teachers who don't get paid. In fact, they get paid $85 a day, and they couldn't even pay that. $85 a day for a teacher. And my mind went back to this whole right-wing assault on teachers in this country, going, that's exactly where they want to take us back to. They want to take us to a time where, you know what, teachers were working for poverty wages, and sometimes we paid them, sometimes we don't. And the people at the top are the ones who get the benefits. Like this woman, this Dr. Hanan, who, you go, really? Dr. Hanan? Okay. Where'd you get your doctorates from, Dr. Hanan? Well, according to her, she got her two doctorates, not just one, but two, and a master's degree from this Rockville University and the Eden Institute. Now, according to the article, it's a well-known diploma mill where you basically send them a couple of bucks and they print you off a diploma. Congratulations, you are now anointed. And the other one, Eden Institute, no one was able to find anything on. And I Googled it, I couldn't find anything. So maybe it exists, maybe it doesn't. Who knows? But again, when you're hiring someone to reorganize your charter school, don't you think you want somebody with credentials? Especially when you look at the fact that they paid this woman tens of thousands of dollars. And don't you think at some point they would have maybe just checked her background a little bit? Because her groups have seemed to have a lot of trouble over the years. The Los Angeles Times reported back in 2008 that about 100 people protest outside of her offices in California, claiming that they were sold free government-issued Section 8 housing vouchers for $1,500 apiece. Now, the vouchers were phony, so you're looking at this going, okay, it's bad enough that you're selling Section 8 vouchers, which are supposed to be free, and I'm pretty sure that's a pretty serious crime. You're selling it to poor people for $1,500, and now they're not even that. They're just complete fakes, and yet these are the people that you start to do business with. Now, this is my problem with the charter schools as a whole. Nobody's minding the store. Think about how powerful this lobby must be, how powerful this movement must be, that we're taking really hard-gotten education dollars and we're stealing from the public schools that are all, some of them are already struggling, especially in neighborhoods like this one, and you're giving them to these charlatans, to these fly-by-night operations. And they're not doing anything. I mean, here in Pennsylvania, this cyber charter thing, really? I think of the 12 there are, or two of them have passed AYP once, maybe? The article goes into some weird relationship between the charter school and Scientology and the Nation of Islam and a whole bunch of stuff, and I don't even want to really get into all of that, but they're claiming there's some liaison between the Church of Scientology and the Nation of Islam, which, again, to me, religion is all about money anyway. It's how much money you can stuff into your pocket, how much you can screw somebody out of. And this is, if it's true that there is a link there, no surprise there whatsoever. The thing that bothers me is these charter schools are being sold to us as this is the way we're going to fix education. We just need to privatize it and get the entrepreneurs in there. Well, I guarantee she's a pretty good entrepreneur. One newspaper in the UK actually Googled a couple of pictures of her. Boy, she's well dressed and well taken care of. I'll tell you that. But at the end of it, who suffers? Well, the kids suffer. And do you know what, for, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, the Life Force School Technology Center got for their money? Her recommendation that they rename the charter school. They want to rename it to the Smart Academy. Science, math, art, reading, and technology. The Smart Academy. And I wonder, and I have to ask, when you have four of the six goals that your school district is saying you need to have as failures, and the two that passed, only 60% of third and fourth graders received those passing grades, I think you really, really have a problem. And the problem is this insane system of saying, here, start whatever you want, and we'll give you some money. We really need to rethink this. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Stephen Hicks from APSCuff about the Pennsylvania State Higher Education funding. Again, another massive shift, another massive redistribution of wealth from us to them. Back after this.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Locked-out employees from American Crystal Sugar and Cooper Tire joined forces last week for a multi-state trip called Journey for Justice. The two companies had locked out employees for months after the employees voted down proposed contracts. While passing through Wisconsin, American Crystal Sugar worker Nathan Rand spoke with WIN executive producer Frank Emsbach on our Madison-based radio program, The People's Mic, with Doug Cunningham.
What were the major issues that you were looking for in terms of a contract settlement? What was the union's position? What did you want to try to do?
Well, the biggest problem is they're basically trying to strip away all of our seniority rights. You know, as far as seniority for jobs, seniority for overtime, they want to eliminate all of that, be able to pick and choose
What does the seniority do for you? Because I think, again, a lot of people, particularly now, don't have contracts that have seniority. So people sometimes get hostile towards that. So what does seniority do for you in the workplace?
Well, the thing is that the biggest deal seniority matters for us is that, you know, you may have somebody that's a 30-year employee that knows our factory inside and out and everything. And you might have a kid that just started, and let's say he's the shift supervisor's nephew. Well, without seniority, they're more apt to give a job to somebody like that over a 30-year employee who already knows the place just because there's a favoritism because he knows somebody. It's not really a battle of us union members. You know, it's more or less keeping out favoritism in that kind of an aspect.
So you're saying that seniority is basically a way to ensure fairness.
Yes, fairness in the workplace, and the people that have been there and put in the most years should have the first shot at jobs. And the thing with our seniority is that they give you a 10-day trial, regardless of whether you've been there for 30 years or 3 years, and they give you a 10-day trial. If at the end of the 10-day trial a company says that you're not going to work out that job, they tell you that they don't want you in that position that you put a bid on, and they go down to the next person in line. The system has worked for us in the 4.5 years that I've been there, and they ultimately end up with the best, quote-unquote, person that they want, so it works just fine. Well, now they want to radically rewrite everything because they say that they need to plan for the future. And we had the most profitable year they've ever had last year. They praised us, patted us on the back, and we made billions of dollars for the company, and now all of a sudden they say that our contract that we've been working under is so horrible, and they have to rewrite it.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
I'm proposing something we haven't had in a long time, a reality-based budget.
To the 80s. You know, Commodore 64, I haven't thought of that in an awful long time. But, you know, going back to the last story I talked about, that's the kind of technology the folks over at the Life Force Church were probably using, or this charter school were probably using, this Scientology Learning How to Learn program, which, you know, again, you know, I look at this, and it's kind of mind-blowing to me. One of the things that jumped out of the article, evidently, you know, there's not a problem with poverty in the world of Scientology, or at least what they're teaching. They're teaching this concept of word clearing, which evidently, you know, all problems just go back to these kids, you know, misunderstanding a word. You know, the struggles that they have in schools aren't no broken home problems, no societal problems, no social problems with the neighborhood, none of that stuff. It's all the kids just misunderstood a word. So here's a dictionary. That, I guess, is their education view. And I'm telling you, I think it's an absolute waste of money. But, you know, here in Pennsylvania, we're pursuing charters as well. So don't be surprised when we hear those stories come home to roost as well. And talking about education, you know, just massive budget cuts I'm seeing being proposed by this governor for the second year in a row. That's why I've asked Steve Hicks, president of APSCUF, the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, to come talk to us about what's going on with funding. Steve, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Yeah, I'm looking at...
be on the air with you.
Yeah, I'm looking at the numbers, and I'm going, you know, at some point, this is just going to devastate working-class folks and people who want to send their kids to college but just can't.
Well, yeah, I don't know that that's not the very agenda that Governor Corbett and people like him are trying to push forward. I mean, I think you probably heard Senator Santorum talking over the weekend that it was snobbish if you wanted everybody to go to college. So what the governor's doing in terms of his budget cuts is going to make it more and more difficult for Pennsylvania and working class and, you know, middle class people to send their kids to college. So, we won't be snobs.
You know, you look at this and you go, you know, elite snobbery came out of his mouth. And I guess that's, you know, part of the belief system of the ultra. Well, here's Rick Santorum.
As I was saying earlier today, the President of the United States came out and said, under my administration, every child should go to college. What elitist snobbery?
What elitist snobbery. And here's the thing. You know, we've been told for years that, you know, go to school, work hard, get into college, get a good education, and that's the path to the middle class. And somehow, according to him, that's snobbery. But, you know, I'm looking at the policies pushed forth by the Republicans, a lot of these Republican governors, and I'm going, snobbery, nothing. They're just stealing it from us.
Well, yeah, yes, they definitely don't have the right agenda. And the problem is they're not looking to the future. Everybody who knows anything about economics and where the world's headed says that we're going to need more education to move from a manufacturing base to a knowledge and technology based economy. And India and China are putting investment into higher education because they want more people with degrees, and we're going in the opposite direction. But, you know, they all want us to be competitive, you know, America first. But, you know, they're not willing to invest in the direction we need to go.
So what are the school presidents saying about this massive funding cut?
University presidents have been pretty quiet about the funding cuts. I think they're probably in shock over the size of the cut after 18% last year and, you know, the mid-year correction, the freeze or rescission of 5% that they were asked for. They've spent a lot of time talking, you know, trying to figure out how their budget works. I know a lot of them, I talked to several of them and hear secondhand off the record that they don't know how they're going to do this. So, you know, they've not had state appropriations that kept up with inflation for the last 12 years. So, you know, the state portion that they deal with is shrinking, and they understand how difficult it is to get students to borrow more money to come to college. And they may have a shrinking student population in a time when it needs to be going the other way.
Yeah, I think the last time I talked to you, you said, you gave me some numbers, like back in 1982, I think it was, you said two-thirds of the funding for higher education came from the government, a third came from student tuition. You said, so I think you said three-quarters of the funding for higher ed is now coming for tuition. Is that right?
That's after last spring. You know, the 11-12 budget went into effect. We were down to a three-quarter state-owned universities. And in 1982, when we became the system, you know, the state relateds at that time, they had about 20% state funding. So, you know, you begin to question, you know, how are we really state-owned? We're beginning to look like, you know, we're what the state relateds are now. And if you look at the cuts, I think lots of people wonder how much longer Penn State, Pitt, and Temple will keep any kind of state identity with where they're at. I think they're down, if these cuts go through, to like 5% state appropriation.
Wow. Yeah. And for me, what that says is we're really pushing forward full bore with the privatization scheme and really the corporatization schemes that we've seen around the country, where we're now making not only the colleges but also, you know, high schools and elementary schools begging to these big corporations, saying, please give us some money, and, oh, by the way, we'll put advertisements and do whatever you want all over the place.
Well, and I think a big concern we have is that when you go begging to the big corporations to fund, you know, your laboratories and so forth, they also get to determine what kind of research you do. You know, are we going to do green research when the Marcellus Shale people are the ones footing the bill, for example?
Excellent point.
And so there's a real concern. One of the greatnesses of American university systems and the research done by American universities is its independence in the way, you know, they've had the money to work outside that kind of influence. And if we become, you know, Marcellus Shale techs, then you worry that we won't be as creative as we could be and solve the problems that we could be solving.
Well, then we won't have to know that the fracking solution is going to kill us and get into the water and make us sick, and we won't have to worry about knowing about air pollution or any of those things, because that won't be the focus of study.
No, that's true. We won't have to worry about any of that or what's been going on in terms of our climate, because, you know, we won't worry about that either.
Yeah, and I look at, there was a story not too long ago, and I sent it around to most of the people I know, that Florida State University got $2 million from the Koch brothers. And they had, according to the article, veto power over any professor hired in their economics department. And I'm going, $2 million to a university the size of Florida State, that to me is just drops in the bucket, even that. But to have that kind of power over curriculum, that kind of power over your faculty, to me, is scary.
Well, yes. I mean, and that's, you know, the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, was founded 100-plus years ago over those very issues, that to keep academic freedom so that professors could go and talk about issues that might go against the grain of people like the Koch brothers. And, you know, we've had that academic freedom for some time, and it's really helped us, you know, have a diverse approach to lots of issues. It's an important feature of the American university system, and if everything's going to be up for sale and you're going to cede control to, you know, outside agencies, you're going to lose that. That's the vital factor in trying to educate our young people. Of course, go back to Senator Santorum. You know, he said this is all about liberal ideology coming out. That's why Obama wants everybody going to college, so we can teach them how to be liberal. So I'm sure you probably have an opinion about that idea.
Oh, well, I've got a couple of them, but
it didn't work for Senator Santorum. Somehow he's gotten through several higher educational institutions. Seem to have failed to make him a liberal.
Yeah, good point. In fact, you know, he went to Dickinson College right here in the listening area.
Right. Penn State and then Dickinson, as I remember his resume.
Yeah, well, again, you know, he lives in a world of his own making, I believe. I think he's got a bunch of folks that are talking to him that none of the rest of us can see. But that's, you know, that's a whole scary thing.
It's a happy world, though.
No, it's a very angry, hateful world. I'd hate to live in that place.
Right.
And if he becomes president, he's going to work to make his reality ours, which I really, wow, that would just...
Yeah, that would be, and pretty clearly not as many people would be going to college under a Santorum administration as there are now. And every think tank that looks into these things thinks we need to be generating more college students and college graduates in the next 10 years, and he would be taking us the other way. And I don't think that would be good for us as a country.
They want to take us back to the 90s.
No, actually, you know, the governor's funding takes us back to 1989 if his proposal goes through. So 1989 is kind of our point at this in time.
I've been saying they want to take us back to the 90s, the 1890s.
The 1890s, yeah, I agree with that. It's clearly a 19th century point of view where there's no public education, and some small sliver of the population, the upper crust, will be going to college. They'll be taking care of us all.
That's, I guess, the way it should be in their world. But now's the time to fight back. So let me ask you, is there a groundswell of activity to restore this funding? Because I remember last year, I saw numerous events across the state, college kids taken to the streets. And I guess it got some money restored, not that much. But will we see that kind of activism relived? Will we see that kind of thing happen again this year?
Well, I've already seen it on several campuses. In fact, this is a student rally week for us on campuses. Last week, Lock Haven University had a rally, and their theme of their rally was the death of higher education, and they carried a coffin through campus and wore black. So you can see the kinds of themes we have. We have lots of campuses doing work this week, having internal meetings, and you'll see more of that. I know Westchester's holding a rally on Wednesday, and off the top of my head, I can't think of another one this week. But then we're having a big rally in Harrisburg on March the 28th. A year ago, we had somewhere around 1,000 students there on the steps of the Capitol.
Yep.
And it was a good day. I know you were there. It was the day of the chancellor's testimony in front of the state House Appropriations Committee. So we're going to have that day again, and then we're having another rally on campuses on April the 16th to talk about national issues in terms of higher ed, because this isn't just a Pennsylvania problem. This is happening across the nation. Almost every state's budget has been cut over the last several years into public higher education. And it looks like they want you to borrow more. There's the direction that you're talking about towards privatization. And so we have those dates highlighted, and you're going to see lots of activity around those dates.
Yeah, what I've been saying is a massive redistribution of wealth. And it's the poor folks at the bottom who can't afford it, who have to take out loans, the people who weren't born with a golden spoon in their mouth. And, I remember, that event that you're talking about, I was getting ready to speak, and I met a kid who said, look, if this funding cut stays, I cannot go back to school. And if I can't go to school, I can't live the life that my parents lived, because the factory's gone. The place where my grandparents worked, my grandmother worked, and my father worked, it's gone. There's nothing for me to go back to.
Yeah, well, I talked to a lot of students last spring who said the same thing to me, that those cuts that the governor proposed had gone through, that they would not have been able to go back to school. And, he didn't get them last year, but he's back for 20% this year. You add it all together, he's almost back to his proposal from last March. He gets this 20%. So we're going to fight this, because all those students deserve a chance to get an education. And, I've seen different definitions of the American dream, but hasn't it always been to do better than your parents did?
Absolutely.
The generation before?
Yep.
And when your parents, like you say, there aren't those manufacturing jobs anymore, how are you going to do better than your parents these days without a college education?
Yeah, and it just shows that, there's a group, on both sides of the aisle, but mostly on the Republican side, who just wants to take that away. And why? So the upper crust can have just a seventh or an eighth vacation home. I guess six or seven isn't enough. We have to have extra. But all along the way, Steve, we want to be part of it. And as these things unfold, we want to have you back to talk about it.
Well, I'll be glad to be back. Thanks for the time, Rick, and thanks for what you do for the labor movement and for working class people across the Commonwealth.
Thanks so much, Steve. Steve Hicks, president of APSCoF, the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Hungry jungle hunters with one on planet eyes. Now that nature's army retreats to hide and cry. So what's it all about?
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
During a recent city council meeting, the mayor of Keene, New Hampshire, leaned over to a council member and whispered excitedly, "We're going to have our own tank." Yes, the tank, or more specifically, the armored personnel vehicle, is the latest must-have play toy for mayors and police departments. Even in this picture-perfect and very tranquil New England town of only about 23,000 residents, Officials get wide-eyed and hurl common sense aside at the very thought of having such a cool ride parked in front of Town Hall, and maybe even getting to drive it in the next 4th of July parade. Never mind that Keene has no crime that would warrant rolling out a tank. Nonetheless, thanks to such richly funded boondoggles as the War on Drugs and the War on Terrorism, the federal government is throwing money at cities and states to militarize their various police forces. Thus, Keene was granted $285,000 by the Department of Homeland Security to buy its very own Bearcat, an 8-ton combat vehicle. Of course, corporations that peddle such pricey hardware testily insist that Keene needs a tank. As a sales executive for Lenco Industries, which makes the Bearcat, snapped to an inquiring reporter, "I don't think there's any place in the country where you can say that is not a likely terrorist target. Wouldn't you rather be prepared?" The sensible people of Keene, however, are not swallowing the fearmonger pill, and they forced the town council to reconsider. Local businesswoman Dory O'Meara says she hasn't met a single person who's in favor of having this militaristic thing in Keene. She calls the tank completely unnecessary, but it's more than that, she adds. It's just not who we are. It's about what kind of town we want to be. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, wherever you live, take heart in the Keene example. Reject the corporate nonsense and insist on being the town you want to be. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money.
Even if it has been money
for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
That economic law. Gold's money. Didn't you know that? Again, every time I hear that, I think infomercial. He has got a career in hawking cheap crap at 3 o'clock in the morning if the president thing doesn't work out, which I'm pretty sure it is not going to happen. But, you know, it's not gold that the folks at the Life Force Arts and Technology Academy were looking for. No. They bankruptcy problems with their charter school? What better way to raise money than to go into a historic hotel that had closed down and rip out all of the copper and all of the wiring and all of the scrap metal? What better way than to ask the parents of your charter school, say, you can help your child by going into this building and ripping out all the copper and all the wire and all the light fixtures and everything out and basically hawking it off. Oh, and did I mention that it was illegal? They broke into a building that they didn't bother telling anybody that they were going to do it. In fact, the guy who owns the building is pretty ticked off about it. Never consented to the demolition. Nothing. They ripped out the entire fire sprinkler system. Yeah, that's the kind of school I want to send my kids to. Yeah, charter schools. Yay! Isn't that great? We could teach them to steal things, that copper. Know what's valuable. And I look at this, and again, while I'm making light of it, the sad reality is this is going on in this country because we have got moneyed interest pushing this idea that we can separate school. We can divide it. We can divide and conquer. This is a massive shift, a massive redistribution of wealth. Education spending is a massive redistribution, and it's going from all of us to them, to the handful. Just like our tax code. I mean, look at our recent tax code. Where are the Republicans? Where are the sane, rational Republicans? Minnesota had one back. He was a congressman, Republican from Minnesota, Herman Anderson. He was from 1939 to 63. He absolutely opposed across-the-board income tax cuts after World War II. Said that they were just a big giveaway to the rich and powerful. He said that, to save workers $45 off their taxes. Anderson asked, why do we have to give our million-dollar income friends $90,000? When I read that, my mind about exploded because that's about what we did during the Bush years, and yet no Republicans decided to raise their hand. Why, for $45-$50, did we have to give the wealth class tens of thousands? Why? And I look at New Jersey. You got Christie, who's got his new proposal. Oh, we're going to cut across the board, 10%. So if you make $50,000 a year in New Jersey, you'll save about $80. Making $1 million, you'll almost $7,300. But that $80, what you're going to have to spend for that, because look, they're privatizing their education. They're privatizing everything there too. So we're the ones, the working people are the ones who constantly get screwed. Because the wealth class, they're going to pay for their kids to go to private school and to college anyway. You're the one who gets cheated out of this. We're the ones who end up getting the short end of the stick. And you look at Romney's proposal. Romney wants to cut 20%. So we got one upsmanship here. Romney wants 20%. So the bottom 20% of people in this country, you'll save about $78. Our one percenters, you'll save about $239,000. Explain to me how that's good policy, especially when you look at the massive cuts in education going on across this country. So Warren Buffett over the weekend was talking about the corporate tax myth. In fact, he, you know, you just kind of shake your head and you go, why aren't we getting this? Buffett came out and said the rate should be around 18.5% or so of GDP as revenue. He said the interesting thing about corporate tax rates is that corporate profits as a percentage of GDP last year were the highest, or just about the highest, in the last 50 years. They were 10 or a fraction of percent GDP. That's higher than we've seen in the last 50 years. He went on to say that the corporate taxes as a percentage of GDP were 1.2%, $180 billion. He said that's about as low as we've seen. So our corporate tax rate last year, effectively, in terms of taxes paid for the U.S., the United States, was around 12%, which is well below those existing in most industrialized countries in the world. So this myth that there's this 35% tax rate out there is nonsense. They're not paying anything like that. So when you look at this, and they keep hammering us with this. Oh, our corporate tax rate, so we need to lower it. In fact, Santorum had a piece in the Wall Street Journal today calling for the 35% to be cut in half. So now you're talking about cutting in half even more. And getting away from education, and getting away from health care, getting away from vital services. Understand. Now, this is the Wall Street Journal, the business newspaper, saying that U.S. corporations paid only 12.1% in taxes on the profits they earned. 12.1, that's it. That's the lowest percentage that they've paid since at least 1972. It used to be 25.6. That was the average between 87 and 2008. So we're seeing a massive, massive redistribution of wealth. The Wall Street Journal also said in 2010, corporate profits had hit an all-time high. So there's money out there, folks. This idea that, oh, we're broke, not flying for me. This idea that is we can't afford to pay for higher education, not flying for me. This idea, oh, we can't have better roads and bridges, we can't have job creation, not flying for me. It's the message that the ultra-right wing wants to keep throwing out at us. And I look at this L.A. Times piece, the city of El Segundo, California. Their city manager, a guy named Doug Wilmore, he said, you know what? We need to get some money into our coffers. The city's struggling. We need to do, there are a lot of things we need to get done. We can't raise property taxes. We've got to think of something. So he gets this idea. He says, okay, Chevron has a refining plant here in El Segundo. We charge them $5 million a year for taxes. That's it. I know up the road, Torrance, California, they get nearly $10 million from Exxon. And Carson got over $10 million from BP. Chevron's paying over 15, almost 15 and a half up north to Richmond, California. So the $5 million we're getting, pretty low. We should raise that up a little bit. Well, he was fired. And you got to wonder, you know, did Chevron have something to do with it? Because evidently Chevron was just, they couldn't believe that they weren't told, that everybody else knew before them. And I find that really hard to believe. But these big moneyed interests, they play for keeps. Because we're not paying attention most of the time. Anything that comes out of the corporate-controlled media, I take with a grain of salt, because all they have become are the megaphones for the mega-rich. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Monday, February 27th. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, you can see all five visible planets sometime between sundown and late evening tonight and for the next several weeks.
South of the equator, you can see four planets. The exception is the most elusive planet, Mercury. In their outward order from the Sun, the visible planets are Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
Start looking for the planets as soon as darkness falls. Look westward first, the direction of sunset. Tonight you'll find the waxing crescent moon above the brilliant planets Jupiter and Venus. When it's dark enough, draw a line downward through the moon, Jupiter, and Venus to locate Mercury near the sunset point on the western horizon.
Now turn to the opposite side of the sky, the east, at nightfall. Mars lurks low in the east when the sun goes down. It's about at its best now for this two-year period, very bright and reddish. You might be able to pick it out just by looking for the brightest, reddest object in the east at nightfall.
The fifth planet, Saturn, is up in the east by about midnight, as seen from around the globe. Saturn shines close to a bright star now, Spica in the constellation Virgo. Saturn looks golden, while Spica sparkles blue-white.
We have sky charts at the Tonight page of EarthSky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, get ready for it, because you heard it here. Steve Hicks said earlier on the program that, you know, they keep saying that we need to have college education to get jobs. Well, we don't have skilled workers. We need to have the best trained workers on the planet. We need to have high education. We need to have skilled workers. Yet you see governors across the country, like our guy here, Tom Corporate, saying, "Oh, we need to slash and burn."
When you start doing that, you drive people into the arms of their autocratic rulers and not toward anything resembling that much-vaunted democracy that we say we favor. The pro-democracy movement in Iran has been squashed like a bug. And it's been squashed like a bug as a result of the assassinations, the sabotage, the underhanded, dirty dealings that we and Israel had engaged in, primarily Israel. Because, frankly, Israel always has to have, especially the right-wing hard-line Israelis, they always have to have a bete noire. They have to have something threatening them to justify the bristling military presence that they insist on maintaining, not to mention their nuclear arsenal. You know, it's kind of funny. The Obama administration sat down with North Korea, offered him some food, and the North Korean said, you know what? I think we can suspend the nuclear program if we can stop starving to death. Now, I'm sure it was said with a little more brusque tone and some bristling and some nastiness back and forth, but that was the gist of it. But we can't take any sort of a similar approach with Iran, because rapprochement with Iran would drive the right-wing bananas. And I don't necessarily know that we want an Iran with a weakened Ahmadinejad. Mousavi Kohaini said Ahmadinejad will be much weaker. Ali Khamenei has the leverage now to respond very strongly and very swiftly. And you can't but argue that some of this was done specifically because of the constant, sickening saber-rattling of the American bloodthirsty right wing. And the irony is not lost on David in Tennessee with regard to Pat Boone. He said, suddenly Patriot Pat, singer of the insipid love ballad, loves the English monarchy? Damn, just like recently the Southern Baptist hard shells are all in love with Israel and the Roman Catholics? Say, what? Bob, I have missed way too many memos. Well, that's okay. We're not getting them either, David. Because the psychotic right wing is just making them up as they go along. They are, the right wing is at this point entrenched in a notion of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And it is causing them to have a lot of weird friends that they have never, ever had before. Our good friend Jude pointing out that Pat Boone will be getting together with John Starve Hagee and a bunch of other Dominionists in short order, coming in May of 2012 at the Crown Plaza Times Square in Manhattan. Each year, the Jerusalem Banquet is an exciting celebration of Jerusalem and our shared Judeo-Christian values that draws local and national leadership from both the Christian and the Jewish communities. This one-of-a-kind gala event includes participation from leading figures from both communities, united in heart and purpose, as together we seek solutions to the rise of an anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Western values, speech, and activity on college campuses.
What, Edith?
Christian leaders such as Jack Hayford, Frederick Casey Price, Pat Boone, John Hagee, Harry Jackson, and others have joined with Jewish leaders including Harvey Kruger, Erwin Hochberg.
Little tiny machine shops that hired 10, 20, 30 people. And they made one thing, and they made it well. Or they made a couple of things, and they made it really well. But those are gone now. Those jobs, where? China. Because that's where the supply chain went. And this has everything to do with the fact that our trade agreements are insane. It's more of this, oh, well, we need to have open borders for goods and services. I mean, the right wing is just nuts over borders. You want to ask them about immigration. They'll tell you about borders. Oh, they love borders. And me, to be honest, I'm a big fan of borders. Love borders. But they only seem to care about borders for people. I like borders for trade. I like borders for capital. I like borders for national identity. I like borders for a lot of reasons. Jobs being right there at the top. If you're going to be an American company, you're an American company. If you're a multinational, you're a multinational. Don't wave the patriotic flag when it suits you. and you look at story after story of how we are losing our manufacturing capacity. Some jobs are coming back, and that's a good thing, and we should be encouraging more of it. Not like the Santorums of the world want, oh, we need to bring pay in the lip service. We need to bring it back. Under what conditions, though, Tricky Ricky? Oh, well, under 1890 conditions? No, we're not going to do that. But I'm looking at this and I'm going, you know, at some point, borders have to be re-erected, and these trade agreements, just nuts. Who do they benefit? Do they benefit you? Can you say, yes, trade with Mexico has made my life better? Trade with China has made us better off? I don't agree. We've got a bunch of cheap stuff, sure. But it's stuff. Is the quality of our life any better? I mean, look at the direction the nation is going. And we are so politically polarized because there's a black guy in the White House. And I truly believe that's the only reason that you're seeing this massive polarization. But if they don't get their way, man, oh, it's class war. You know, whenever we start saying, you know, we want education, we want health care, oh, class war! You know, where are the Republicans when workers say, you know what, we'd like to have rights? Oh, we'll give you rights, all right. You have the right, well, the right to die. It reminds me of the one book I read on the coal miner. You know, at the end of the book, the guy who they were talking about, on his headstone, they wrote something along the lines of 40 years of pick and shovel. You know, now here I lie, you know, free from the boss, finally, once and for all. But we're talking about another insane trade agreement. This Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement? Really? We're going to make Vietnam the next China? And why? Well, we know why. Because the billionaire class's insatiable appetite for more never ends. Their want, their need, their appetite never ends. How many vacation homes do you need? 6, 7, 10? I mean, when McCain was running for president, he had, what, 7 houses? 8? They didn't even know. How much does the billionaire class need? Because I'll tell you what the folks at the bottom need. I'll tell you what middle-income folks need. They need education. They need health care. They need opportunity. They need job security. They need retirement security. That's what we should be focusing our politic on. But instead, what do they give us? Well, they give us abortion and contraception. They give us nonsense. Sad, sad, sad. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk about this thing in Georgia, House Bill 469, or Senate Bill 469, back after this.
My two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Lockout employees from American Crystal Sugar and Cooper Tire joined forces last week for a multi-state trip called Journey for Justice. The two companies had locked out employees for months after the employees voted down proposed contracts. While passing through Wisconsin, American Crystal Sugar worker Nathan Rand spoke with WIN executive producer Frank Emsbach on our Madison-based radio program, The People's Mic, with Doug Cunningham.
What were the major issues that you were looking for in terms of a contract settlement? What was the union's position? What did you want to try to do?
Well, the biggest problem is they're basically trying to strip away all of our seniority rights. You know, as far as seniority for jobs, seniority for overtime, they want to eliminate all of that, be able to pick and choose who they want.
What does the seniority do for you? Because I think, again, a lot of people, particularly now, don't have contracts that have seniority. So So, and people sometimes get hostile towards that. So what does seniority do for you in the workplace?
Well, the thing is that the biggest deal seniority matters for us is that, you know, you may have somebody that's a 30-year employee that knows our factory inside and out and everything. And you might have a kid that just started, and let's say he's the shift supervisor's nephew. Well, without seniority, they're more apt to give a job to somebody like that over a 30-year employee who already knows the place just because there's a favoritism because he knows somebody.
So you're...
It's not really a battle of us union members, you know, it's more or less keeping out favoritism and that kind of that kind of an aspect.
So you're saying that seniority is basically a way to ensure fairness.
Yes, fairness in the workplace, and the people that have been there and put in the most years should have the first shot at jobs. And the thing with our seniority is that they give you a 10-day trial, regardless of whether you've been there for 30 years or 3 years, and they give you a 10-day trial. If at the end of the 10-day trial the company says that you're not going to work out that job, they tell you that they don't want you in that position that you put a bid on, and they go down to the next person in line. The system has worked for us in the 4.5 years that I've been there, and they ultimately end up with the best, quote-unquote, person that they want, so it works just fine. Well, now they want to radically rewrite everything because they say that they need a plan for the future. And we had the most profitable year they've ever had last year. They praised us, patted us on the back, and we made billions of dollars for the company, and now all of a sudden they say that our contract that we've been working under is so horrible and they have to rewrite it.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Ever check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So, you know, the more I look around the country, the more I'm thinking that the Republican Party has lost its ever-loving freaking mind. And Georgia, one of the places I think completely lost in the dust. I look at this Senate Resolution 889, where they want to nullify any law that they deem not in their interest. Well, they want to nullify any federal law. They want to be able to say, well, you know what, if there's a mandate or a statute that we don't like that came out of the federal government, we're just not going to, we're not going to do it. Now think about it. You know, this was the beginning of the movement towards the Civil War. This was the beginning of that. And as James Madison said back then, nullification would put a speedy end to the Union in itself. Basically, they're moving us down that path again. And not only that, you know, this whole, as I've been calling it, the Shaft-Hartless bill, Georgia Senate Bill 469, basically Taft Hartley for those of us who aren't in unions or aren't workers, saying that, you know what, if you're going to protest, no, it's going to be against the law. And we're going to fine you for it. Maybe jail, a felony. Just absolutely nuts. I've asked Ben Spate. He's the organizing director for Teamsters Local 728 down in Atlanta, also the co-chair of Atlanta's Jobs with Justice, to come talk to us about that. Ben, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick. It's good to be on the show.
You know, I look at this Senate Bill 469, what I've been calling the Shaft-Hartless bill, and I'm saying, you know, as I'm looking at the situation, it's aimed directly at you and the Occupy movement there in Atlanta for the work that you're doing with foreclosed homeowners, for workers groups like AT&T. Your thought?
Well, look, you know, this is no surprise in this climate that we have right now, where working people are in a deep crisis. We're not out of this recession yet. In fact, the right and their corporate buddies feel emboldened to come after us. They're not learning the lessons of 2011 that, you know, people organize and actually have the power. They're actually thinking, you know what, this is a green light for us to come after labor, the Occupy movement, and all those that are concerned with social and economic injustice. And, you know, just to back up a little bit, I was born and raised in Georgia, and I hate for the country to think of Georgia as this pariah when really, this bill is part and parcel of a greater scheme. What's going on with Senate Bill 469 in Georgia is that the principal sponsors of this bill are all members of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. that's been putting out these template corporate-backed pieces of legislation attacking unions throughout the country. I mean, that's what this is about. They put in a section in there specifically targeting forms of nonviolent civil disobedience and direct action, which you referenced a moment ago about the foreclosure actions that have been successful in keeping banks from kicking working families out of homes here in Atlanta, and that's principally been led by Occupy Atlanta. What happened on February 13th, though, is nothing less than historic, and that is labor through Communication Workers of America 3204, which represents AT&T workers in Atlanta, Jobs with Justice, and Occupy Atlanta, did a surprise civil disobedience at AT&T's corporate offices here in Midtown Atlanta, where we got into the building and did a sit-down. Well, we were all charged, and I was one of them. We were arrested, and we were all charged with a criminal misdemeanor for trespassing. This law, this bill, came out the next week, and it specifically targeted those forms of action by making the planning of such action, the planning of a civil disobedience like that, even if it was nonviolent, a felony under Georgia law. So it's absolutely clear to us that it's no coincidence that AT&T and other corporate interests in town and the banks worked with these Republican senators to draft this bill through ALEC and to have it proposed. And tomorrow there's going to be a hearing at the Georgia State Capitol. Coincidentally, we're having a labor day there where hundreds of rank-and-file union members and teamsters are going to be at the Capitol. We're going to attend that hearing, and we're going to let our voice be heard the following day. Occupy Atlanta is also organizing a demonstration against Senate Bill 469.
Oh, I'm glad someone's fighting against it, because I'm looking at this and I'm completely enraged, because I know if it works in Atlanta, if it works in Georgia, it's going to find its way to Pennsylvania eventually and then across the country. How's the local media taking this? Are local folks upset about it? What kind of response are you getting?
The media here in town is, you know, the mainstream media, as it is elsewhere, is firmly in the hands of corporate interests. But there are entities that are picking it up from your program, obviously. There's community radio here in Atlanta, and other smaller venues are picking it up. But what's very clear here is that the way that this law is written, it's so broad. It encompasses all progressive social forces in our state. Everybody from women's rights organizations to the LGBT community to labor to Occupy, everybody that's ever raised a grievance with their government or company. It's so you have the provision in there that says that first off, you have to reauthorize every union member in the state of Georgia. We currently have the second lowest union density rate in the country. 4% of the total workforce is in unions. They want to make that zero. So it would require every union member to reauthorize their checkoff annually, which is just an extra burden on unions to go out there and collect dues year-round.
Yeah.
It also gives union members the right to revoke their membership at any time. Right now, their ability to do so is negotiated in our collective bargaining agreement. We already have a relationship with these employers about how members can join and not in a right-to-work state. So that's the union part of it. The other parts of it that's broad to encompass all social, you know, progressive forces in our state is that you can't have a picket outside of either a private residence or a company if you're disturbing the peaceful enjoyment of those inside those buildings. Well, that's the exact wording, the peaceful enjoyment. Last time I checked, every time we have a demonstration, the purpose of it is to disturb the peace and to say that our lives are being affected by the policies of these companies and these governments. So even this routine tradition of labor of forming a picket line outside of an employer or the residence of a CEO, now that would be punishable by fines of $1,000 per day for each picketer and $10,000 a day for the organization, with the possibility of an injunction issued against the organizations and the individuals involved in that picket. And then Section 5, as I said, would make it a felony to engage and plan a civil disobedience. So this is so broad. You know, Rick, it actually helps labor, because the right and corporate interests often try to frame us as some sort of special interest that's just concerned about our members. What this actually does and speaks to is that our interests are the interests of all working people and all people that are concerned about the direction of this company, this country, being taken over by corporate power. everybody that's at any time raised such grievances that we have a constitutionally protected right to do so is now being criminalized. And in Georgia, we're a three strikes, you're out state. So if you get three felonies, you're done. And a felony in Georgia is a minimum of 1 year in state prison and a $10,000 fine.
So you look back at
our heroes in history, Dr. King, how many times did he get arrested for criminal trespass and civil disobedience? He would be a felon. Rosa Parks would be a felon. And that's what they're trying. They're trying to take us back 80 years, Rick.
You know, I've been saying they want to take us back to the 1890s, and looking at the policies that are being put forth. And again, you know, in a series of ALEC-type bills where the corporate masters and the billionaire class have decided that they've had enough with the rabble, they've had enough with the occupiers. It's time for everybody to go and do what they want to do as long as they don't cause any trouble or heaven forbid, ask for equality or ask for a decent wage. And at the end of this, I don't know why people aren't in the streets by the millions at this point with all of the information that's out there.
Well, I think it's our duty, okay, first and foremost as organizers, to get out there and educate the public. That's why I'm so proud to have a program like yours that gets out to so many different people across this country that can listen and understand what's at stake. But, you know, they count on us being asleep, and they count on labor to just rely on traditional methods like lobbying and writing checks and asking them not to do this and using procedural ways to get around this. The reality, this bill is for real. And they really are intent on pushing it through. And we simply cannot wait for anything else to happen. It's not going to be either one of the parties that come and save us. It's not going to be some elected official. It's not going to be necessarily a legal means on its own to resolve this. If they want, this is about basic freedoms and human rights, okay? If we don't defend those, they're going to be taken from us aggressively in our face. And that's what this is. And you're right. If they think they can get away with it in a state like Georgia. But it should be a message to everybody from New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, and California, and Michigan, and other places where we have strong union membership. You know, they've already started to try to pass these right-to-work laws. Look what happened in Indiana. Yep. They thought that they can get away with it there, and now they're coming to Georgia. So the right and their corporate buddies have a national movement. Are we going to start to push our envelopes and to think about new tactics and a new strategy to combat this? And one of the things that we have to do is to tell people it's not just about union. It's not just about collective bargaining rights. Do you even want to have a democracy anymore? Because that's what's at stake. They're literally, through laws and through these bills, stripping us of our basic democratic rights. What we're going to end up as, and this is not just hyperbole, we're going to end up like Syria, where people that rise up, okay, are literally pushed down through the most extreme oppressive means. This is what this is. Imagine 100 people who sit out there and protest, sit down nonviolently, get locked up for felonies for a year. We're going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of political prisoners in this state as a result of this bill. And that's just not rhetoric. That's what they want to happen. They want to demoralize all of our movements and say, we're going to lock you up, okay, and we're going to throw away the key if you do bold actions like a civil disobedience. Frankly, Rick, I think that we all ought to be engaging and think about when it's appropriate and when we need to escalate to put pressure on these entities to engage in nonviolent, noncompliance, and direct action.
I'm right there with you.
We have to put our bodies in the line because it destroys working families and it destroys the middle class when they take away our union rights, which is what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I've said that about actions on the job, about them coming in trying to foreclose on people's homes. You name it, I think direct action is the best way to go. And as we've seen these occupations around the country, you know, there's a lot of talk out there that the 1%'s all afraid. I don't think so, because I think the 1% knows that they've got legislatures like the one in Georgia, here in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, that they've bought and paid for enough politicians to make sure that they don't have to be afraid.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've been fired on the job for organizing. I've seen people that I've worked with fired on the job. I've seen other forms of retaliation. We've been arrested. We've seen, you know, police come out there and shoot at us with rubber bullets and tear gas. I've been organizing in Georgia for 14 years, but I've never seen them, a corporation, work with legislators to specifically draft a piece of legislation in direct response to an action that we took. That to me, does smack of the fact that they're afraid, because if they're responding directly to something that we've done. So I think that we need to continue to do it. We need to turn up the heat, but we also need to just put it on blast as much as we can that this is the party of small government, right? Then why are you trying to interfere between our dispute, two parties dispute, the union and the workers dispute with companies, and you're going to interfere with that process, the collective bargaining process, by telling us what we can or cannot negotiate in our contracts and tell us exactly how are we going to interact with the company when we have a dispute, whether or not we can have a mass picket or have a form of direct action. This is big government at its worst. And I think that any of these conservatives that are out there listening or folks that are really concerned about the power of government should be looking at how government and corporations are working hand in hand to take away our basic democratic rights. If they're really about freedom and they keep preaching about freedom, shouldn't a working person have the freedom to assemble, to ask the government for redress of their grievances?
Absolutely.
Organize.
The problem with the conservatives right now is they're blinded by abortion and gay marriage and all that nonsense that that their party leaders keep feeding them.
You know, I think that the labor movement is the antidote to fix this economy. If we don't have workers that are making a rise in income, that are having stable jobs, and we're letting these companies like AT&T, this whole thing started by AT&T laying off 740 workers. They're the second most profitable corporation in the world. Their CEO has a $27 million compensation plan. They go and blow billions of dollars in this attempted buyout of T-Mobile, and they don't want the workers to take the tab on the bill for that failed business decision. And this protest and this demonstration that we continue to camp outside of AT&T's corporate offices here in Midtown, Atlanta, is that we're just saying enough is enough. And so it finally, when we did that here in the South, they respond with this kind of law. And I think that if there's anything that anybody else around the country can do, tomorrow the Labor and Insurance Committee of the Senate will be having their first hearing on this bill. Again, Senate Bill 469. The principal sponsor of it is a guy named Don Balfour, who's a vice president of Waffle House, for those that may be familiar with Waffle House. Okay? They're all members of ALEC. Help us by calling, looking up Senate Bill 469. I don't know if they can link to it on your website.
We'll
but calling
sure
these sponsors done. And telling them that this whole country is watching, that we're not going to allow this to happen in Georgia. You know, in the labor movement, we had the saying, what, you know, we talk about solidarity, but an injury to one is an injury to all of us. We have to draw the line in the sand, and it feels like we're fighting battles on fronts across this country, because we are. And it's really a wake-up call to the labor movement and our leadership and our rank and file, that I know you're concerned with the day-to-day issues on the job and on the shop floor. We got to keep fighting those things too. I know you're concerned about organizing non-union workers. We got to keep doing that too. But you know what? If we don't close ranks now and to have an all-out approach to it, we're going to go from 4% in the state of Georgia to 0%. We're going to have a labor movement that literally ceases to exist.
And that's
what
that's
does that really mean for our democracy?
That is their goal, a desperation class that they want to continue to create. Ben Spate, we will make sure that we get the information for Senate Bill 469 up at our website. I appreciate the time. Keep up the fight down there, brother. And as this goes on, I'd love to talk to you again.
Thank you, brother. Take care.
All right. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith.
During a recent city council meeting, the mayor of Keene, New Hampshire, leaned over to a council member and whispered excitedly, "We're going to have our own tank." Yes, the tank, or more specifically, the armored personnel vehicle, is the latest must-have play toy for mayors and police departments. Even in this picture-perfect and very tranquil New England town of only about 23,000 residents, officials get wide-eyed and hurl common sense aside at the very thought of having such a cool ride parked in front of Town Hall, and maybe even getting to drive it in the next 4th of July parade. Never mind that Keene has no crime that would warrant rolling out a tank. Nonetheless, thanks to such richly funded boondoggles as the War on Drugs and the War on Terrorism, the federal government is throwing money at cities and states to militarize their various police forces. Thus, Keene was granted $285,000 by the Department of Homeland Security to buy its very own Bearcat, an 8-ton combat vehicle. Of course, corporations that peddle such pricey hardware testily insist that Keene needs a tank. As a sales executive for Lenco Industries, which makes the Bearcat, snapped to an inquiring reporter, "I don't think there's any place in the country where you can say that is not a likely terrorist target. Wouldn't you rather be prepared?" The sensible people of Keene, however, are not swallowing the fearmonger pill, and they forced the town council to reconsider. Local businesswoman Dory O'Meara says she hasn't met a single person who's in favor of having this militaristic thing in Keene. She calls the tank completely unnecessary, but it's more than that, she adds. It's just not who we are. It's about what kind of town we want to be. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, wherever you live, take heart in the Keene example. Reject the corporate nonsense and insist on being the town you want to be. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender and woman at arms. Just got time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for the hammer.
Yeah, I look at this, and again, I go back to this Senate Bill 469, and it's one of those moments where you go, I don't know how much more blatant they can possibly be. This is obviously something that they've wished for years. Every time there's a direct action, every time there's a protest, every time a group of people say, you know what, corporate America is screwing us, we need to do something about it, they go, wish we had a law. And now they're pushing this forward. Going to take your right for any secondary action. You'll still be able to go to your government every once in a while when they give you a permit. But if you decide that, you know, this XYZ corporation is killing people or screwing something up or screwing their workers, you can't go and say anything. And it's one of the things that I've said for quite some time. What they do is they put themselves in very isolated situations with big fences and industrial parks on private property, so that they're insulated from the rabble. Good luck protesting on private property. And I go back, you know, the Constitution was supposed to say, instead of, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of private property. That was originally the first thought. Then they threw in the happiness because, you know, the Enlightenment and all, John Locke and all that. But private property was first and foremost. The wealth class, the ownership class, the property owners, they wanted to make sure that they held superiority, that they reigned supreme, that they were in charge, no matter what. And the rest of you, the rabble, well, you do what you were told. And this just plays into this for me. And, you know, the fact that it's a southern state, again, another one of those moments where you go, well, yeah, wouldn't you think? And the fact that we're going to make, like, and it was a good point. I had watched this thing over the weekend about Martin Luther King. I sat and watched it for about an hour with my daughter. And it was one of those moments where you go, was this our country? Is this where we were? You know, in this kind of an environment where, and my daughter, who's 9, could not even fathom a world where there were drinking fountains that were for whites and for blacks. Cannot even, and that's a good thing. Like, I can't fathom a day where I'm not going to be able, when I'm angry about something, to go out and protest and to make signs and get out and be heard. I cannot fathom what that looks like. And you stop and you think about privatizing prisons. This is making it a felony. Three strikes and you're out? Really? Life in prison for protesting? And I guess, you know, you look at the profit motives out there, maybe this is part of it as well. But the bigger part is to keep you in your place. And to never question why, and to never question the authority that the corporate masters have. Now, the megaphones for the mega rich will say, well, you know, it's private property, that's the owner of a private business. They should be able to do whatever they want because it's a free enterprise system. If it was a free enterprise system, then I would have the ability to go and voice my displeasure, correct? It's free. Not in Georgia, evidently. And I would suggest if you have the time, we'll try and get the numbers up to call this the vice president of Waffle House. You know, why don't we just elect nothing but CEOs in all of our positions? We can have the corporation of America. You know, we joke about it, and you see the flags, and you see the funny ha-ha stuff, but for the most part, we're bought and paid for by the big multinationals, and our politicians basically do what the big corporate interests want, what the special interest and what the donor class wants. You and I, if anything good happens for you or me, purely by accident. I mean, in the last 30 years, can anybody name a piece of legislation that benefited solely working people? Because I'm trying to think of some. You know, you could throw out the Family Leave Act, but is it really of a benefit if you can't afford to take it off? 12 unpaid weeks? How many families in this country can afford to miss a paycheck for 12 weeks? Very, very few. Yeah, I know it's good for a day or two here or a couple of days here, but at the end of it, you know, other countries, so much further ahead. So you want to talk about family values? So much further ahead than us. But we're business friendly. And I guess so business friendly that we're going to insulate our corporate masters from any dissent by passing laws like this one in Georgia and the other one that I talked about. We're going to nullify any federal law that we don't agree with? Not going to happen. Unconstitutional. But again, this is how you rally the fringe characters. And I would have to think that even in Georgia, neither of these pieces of legislation can have much popular support. You know, we see this stuff happen like in the middle of the night, thieves in the middle of the night proposing things on the hush-hush. And then, oh, when it happens, oh, that's a law? Active, engaged, informed. That's what our electorate needs to be. We need people who are going to get out in the streets. We need people who are going to take to the polls in November. If what you've seen since November of 2010, since the Republicans have really, really come into power, if you think that's the direction this nation needs to go, then vote for the same idiots who put us on this path. But if not, if you see the hypocrisy and you see the nonsense, you got to get out in November. I'm a big throw these bums out, throw them out now kind of guy. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the what's going on in Michigan, which is another mind blower. Stick around. Right back after this.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, Sky.
Monday, February 27th. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, you can see all five visible planets sometime between sundown and late evening tonight and for the next several weeks.
South of the equator, you can see four planets. The exception is the most elusive planet, Mercury. In their outward order from the Sun, the visible planets are Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
Start looking for the planets as soon as darkness falls. Look westward first, the direction of sunset. Tonight you'll find the waxing crescent moon above the brilliant planets Jupiter and Venus. When it's dark enough, draw a line downward through the moon, Jupiter, and Venus to locate Mercury near the sunset point on the western horizon.
Now turn to the opposite side of the sky, the east, at nightfall. Mars lurks low in the east when the sun goes down. It's about at its best now for this two-year period, very bright and reddish. You might be able to pick it out just by looking for the brightest, reddest object in the east at nightfall.
The fifth planet, Saturn, is up in the east by about midnight, as seen from around the globe. Saturn shines close to a bright star now, Spica in the constellation Virgo. Saturn looks golden, while Spica sparkles blue-white.
We have sky charts at the Tonight page of EarthSky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
I love this country. I should love this state. It just feels good being back in Michigan. You know, the trees are the right height. The streets are just right.
There is trouble in the forest.
One of my favorite organizing songs of all times. There's Rush, you know. And I gotta, what the heck is he talking about, the trees? I've been to Michigan. I don't think their trees are much different than Ohio's or Wisconsin's, but you know, evidently this guy, he's brought it up a couple of times. Just insane. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. A lot of things going on in Michigan. And like we were talking about in Georgia, you know, direct action there, people taking to the streets, people getting involved. I like what I'm seeing in Michigan. That's why I've asked Brandon Jessup, founder of Michigan Forward, to come talk to us about his group and what they're doing there to fight back on the little dictators that their governor has been appointing. Brandon, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, no problem. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no, I appreciate anybody doing direct action and getting out in the streets. And as I understand, you guys are putting something on your ballot to do away with these little dictators. I saw you needed something like 160,000 signatures. You've got something like 250,000. Is that correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. We are almost at 225,000 signatures to repeal Governor Snyder's, what we call it is the evil dictator law. As of right now, he's installed dictators in four cities already. I mean, even after this past week when we found him violating our Open Meetings Act, which would give disclosure and accountability to all the actions that he's been taking in communities in financial distress, he went back and now he's looking to dissolve an entire school district just because he couldn't get his way. So we're going to spank some of these spoiled conservatives here in the state of Michigan with our repeal effort, and we're going to vote this ballot, this evil dictator bill down in November.
I sure hope so, because, you know, as I say about a lot of the nastiness going around, if it's not in Georgia or Wisconsin or Ohio or even in Michigan, that stuff, if it flies there, will find its way here to Pennsylvania or find its way to other states. So
Absolutely.
If we can stop it where it grew, if we can stop it where it started, so much better for the rest of the nation.
Absolutely, and you know, and it's funny because a lot of these conservative think tanks here in Michigan, they are all across the Rust Belt and all across the Midwest. Our emergency manager bill, actually, from what I heard, that there was a similar version being discussed in Pennsylvania for the city for your state capital.
Yes,
and then also that guy down there in Indiana, Mitch Daniels, when they couldn't get their way on collective bargaining. They're looking at similar legislation right now in Indiana. And I want to talk about why this legislation is so bad. Right now, our governor, under disguise of a financial a crisis in the school district or any municipality, can appoint his own unelected bureaucrat to unilaterally cancel all public contracts, to remove elected officials, and also to sell any and all public assets that that municipality or school district may hold. So what does that mean? For the city of Detroit, that means that 72% of our traditional public schools have been closed after we passed over $800 million in funding and budget proposals and municipal bonds to build brand new schools in the district over the last 7 years. Now he's taking those brand new schools that we've just built and he's turning them over to private interests.
Of course he has.
Absolutely, absolutely. And our deficit hasn't increased. Our deficit hasn't decreased. This emergency manager, this dictator, came in with a deficit of just over $50 million. Now the deficit is $327 million, and we have 50 kids per classroom in some schools. We are not getting any of the results that we asked for, and we got to stop this dictator bill today.
Yeah, I know. I had actually talked to someone from one of your school districts, I forget which one it was, where the fire marshal had actually cited the school for a fire code violation by having 55 children in a kindergarten class. And I keep telling people, folks, look at what's going on around you. That's going to come to a school district near you. The one down in Florida we talked about earlier in the program, this charter school where they brought in this profiteer who has just done some of the most mind-blowing things, bankrupted this charter school, but her pockets are full.
Absolutely.
That's where we're headed.
Absolutely. And these guys, these unelected dictators that we have here in Michigan, they can earn up to $400,000 a year. And then also they can double their profits by finding their own funders and fundraisers throughout the state and also nationally. So what we've seen is not only just the greedy corporate CEOs come in with their big pocketbooks and big checks, we're also finding some of these conservative foundations and think tanks subfunding some of the same activity. So, you know, we're losing on both ends here in Michigan. But the great thing is, and I got to say this, as the conservatives try to make this a race issue, it's not. This is an issue about democracy and local representation. And it perplexes some that the Tea Party hasn't stood up against this overreach of big government into our communities.
Well,
but
the great thing
about it is that progressives all across this state have said no to this law. And honestly, we've done this with a full volunteer effort. This has not had, we have not paid for any signatures that we've collected. We've been collecting for the last 6 months, and on Wednesday, we'll be marching over 200,000 petitions to Lansing.
Well, that sounds like a great thing, but understand the Tea Party is nothing but a billionaire construct. They made
that. Oh, yeah, we know that.
I mean, they've created that out of nowhere. They got a couple of people to come out and get outraged and point their finger around, but at the end of the day, it's a billionaire construct. What I find particularly interesting about this is for the folks who believe in local government, and the Republicans keep telling us they want small, less intrusive, localized government. Even here in Pennsylvania, our governor, Tom Corporate, he decided that in the Marcellus Shale areas, there can be no local control. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised. I've watched this long enough. I know these people well enough that the rhetoric doesn't meet the action.
Absolutely not.
But the hope is that groups like yours and others will wake people up. The mindless conservative goes in there and goes, yeah, I believe in the strong BS, and pulls the lever. Hopefully in November we pull the lever the other way.
Well, yeah, and you know what? Our effort to stand up for democracy, our key argument, not just Michigan 4, but also Michigan Ask Me Council 25, the Michigan AFL-CIO, and the Michigan Educators Association, and thousands of teachers and just everyday working folks, we've been beating the bushes hard, and independents are starting to realize the fact that Public Act 4 is wrong, that emergency management is wrong, that dictatorship flies in the face of democracy. So we can't turn back the clock on the way we govern ourselves. We got to turn really and put some interest into the way we do govern ourselves.
Absolutely.
Yes, we've had some poor elected officials, and what we can do with those guys, we vote them out. They're saying we're going to vote out this governor in the next 3 years. And the great thing I have to keep saying is if it wasn't for the progressive voice, Michigan would probably be overrun with crazy dictators right now.
Yeah.
But the poll numbers show 60% of Michigan does not like this law. And we're going to keep on beating the bushes until we get a mandate to take this law off the books.
I sure hope you succeed on it. And you hit on a point there I think is extremely important. The term limits you were talking about. My favorite term limit is the vote.
Absolutely. 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 We've seen quite a few recall measures come across this state in local state house races. And tomorrow, we got a great presidential primary that's going on, but we will probably win some seats in the House again tomorrow as well. So we're excited here in Michigan.
Yeah, I'm sure hope, because Michigan's one of those states that I always saw as a solidly reliable working class state that didn't go too far off the deep end. I know you got your northern problems there, but for the most part, it was a solidly working class state. Let me ask you, go back to these little dictators, because you brought up something about public contracts and these little czar guys being able to break any public contract. What about private contracts? Do they have the ability
to
break those?
They have absolutely no say-so over private contracts, which once again shocks us, because it's the private contracts that are breaking our communities. Right here in the city of Detroit, our mayor decided to give a private vendor the contract to fix our city buses. Right now, over 60% of our city buses don't run. And we can't get the city buses that are already in stores under this private contractor, because he doesn't believe that we have the ability to pay here in the city of Detroit. So now you see our private contractors holding the city hostage, that thousands of people who rely on mass transit can't get mass transit because we have a private contractor that wants to hold out for his own personal gain. Now the other part of that is this. We're paying three times as much for this private contractor as we would for the paid union public labor that we already have here in the city of Detroit. So, you know, we're being gouged on one end because our public workers can't work, and then we're also being killed on the other end by the private industry that wants to milk our community and really wants to go after our pension, which is one of the healthiest pensions in the nation, right here in the city of Detroit, having over $300 million in assets. So,
yeah, I mean, of course you do.
Mm-hmm.
Of course you do. Let me ask you about tomorrow's primary. And one of the first things, the question that's been just batting around my head, and I alluded to it at the opening, what's with the trees? are they different? Because I've been through Michigan. Are they different? Did I miss that day? Was there a memo that I missed? What?
You know, I don't know what Governor Romney was talking about. The trees that I hear in Detroit, are just the same as any other tree in the country. And, you know, it just shows, I mean, this guy's out of touch. This is the same person who held a 1,500 person rally and a 68,000 person arena for a field. This is the same person that 2 days prior had just trashed the entire auto industry and wished it to tank. But it's ironic that he held a major speech on Friday at Ford Field. So this is par for the course of Republicans here in the state. I know quite a few progressives will be voting around Paul here in Michigan. I myself, I'll be staying at home.
Yeah, well, vote for Santorum. Go vote for Santorum.
Push him out there.
I want to see this whole primary thing end up into April and make Pennsylvania a decision-making state at some point.
Hey, you know what? Well, we'll hand it over to you as long as you guys handle the problem. we'll definitely punt it over to Pennsylvania.
There
it's not
go.
An issue.
There you go. Because I got to be honest with you, I really don't want to see the really just mean-spirited, angry, divisive politic that the Republicans have brought to our public discourse continue. At some point, we, the voting people, have to exercise our right to term limit and throw the bums out.
Well, you know, and I think some of the conservatives here that are ready to throw those bums that are already campaigning now, they're anticipating one of the lowest turnouts in the primary that we're spending $10 million for. And it's a shame that we're wasting taxpayers' money here in Michigan to hold a primary that no one's really excited about, when we could be doing what with that $10 million. I think I could find quite a few books to purchase for school kids. I can put some more officers on the street here in the city of Detroit or in other places across the state, but yet, we're playing politics tomorrow. So
that's a sad thing. Let me ask you a last question I've got for you. You've got these little dictators, the four of them. What are some of the more bizarre, just so people have an idea of what we're talking about, what are some of the more bizarre decisions that they've made that benefit them but not maybe people like you or working folks in the state of Michigan?
Well, you know, let's start from the top, and I can give you this one instance about Pontiac. 3 days before the city of Pontiac held their general election, this past November, the emergency manager, Lou Schimmel, fired the city clerk. Now, this was 3 days before we had a huge election for the city of Pontiac, where they replaced a conservative House member in their district. So that's just one instance. Also in Pontiac, we heard about the Pontiac Silverdome where the Detroit Lions used to play.
Yep.
That's a $55 million structure. That structure was sold for $500,000 in 2009.
I remember that.
Also, you see, right just recently here in the city of Flint, after Governor Snyder placed his own dictator in the city of Flint, this dictator immediately locked out all of the elected officials, the city councilmen, and the mayor from their offices for 2 weeks. While he did that, he also dissolved the city's community block grants department. He also dissolved the federal grant department. Why? Because he didn't want to see the nonprofit community and also the small business community have access to the grants that are already here in the city of Flint. So what we're seeing is that we see emergency managers cut public access not just to the vote but also to economic growth. And that's exactly what we need to happen in our communities, not cuts. We need revenue generation, and that's not happening from our emergency managers.
Yeah, I mean, they've got one goal in mind, that's slash and burn, cut, and punish. And I guess that would lead to me to believe conservatives, as they do nothing but cause great harm and misery.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, their main creditor and their main point and purpose is to pay our creditors, is to pay big banks that continuously gouge our communities. It's very tough to get out of a financial crisis when you know your housing values continue to fall. And our governor has not done a lick of any effort to restore our property values across this state. The city of Detroit still leads the state in foreclosures as well as Wayne County. And we're not getting the relief that we need, and that's why we got to get some changes in November.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. They make sure we pay the 1%, don't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And let me remind you, our state's earned income tax credit was cut. And also now our seniors pay a tax on their pension. So we are definitely bleeding from both ends here. But our fight to repeal this emergency manager law will force the governor to review their budget and hopefully bring us some more tax relief that we need in the meantime and get democracy back in order very soon.
I can't wait. Tomorrow we will know tomorrow? Is that what's...
Wednesday. We are marching our petitions up at 1 p.m.
Okay.
Definitely Michigan Ford and the Stand Up for Democracy Committee. We appreciate all the national attention that we've been getting, and international attention. So we want to keep that up, keep raising the voice for democracy. And if anybody wants any more information, they can visit us at michiganforward.org.
And we will make sure we get a link at thericksmithshow.com. Brandon, Jessup, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. And I'd love to have you back at some point in the near future.
Hey, I'll see you soon. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Thanks so much. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Save USA, and resume those ties of mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed her permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So the radical right's all upset. They're saying that Mitt Romney and Ron Paul have entered into an unholy alliance. And, you know, even the Think Progress people have said that Ron Paul has an attack strategy. It's basically anybody but Romney. Ron Paul's going after Santorum. He's gone after Gingrich. He's gone after Perry. Gone after Cheesy Dwarf. Even once went after poor Michelle Bachmann. But Santorum, more than anyone, and by far away, just attacking Santorum. And I'm going, well, you know why? Because Santorum's nuts. I mean, you know, I don't know that there's any real coalition there. Maybe there is. I know when Ron Paul's jet broke down, Romney offered, you know, to have his jet take him home to Texas. Okay, I get that. You just want to be nice. You know, when the 1% go out, they try to be nice to each other. They also say, you know, some people are saying that, you know, their ads look a lot alike, and it seems to be maybe a little coordinated. I don't know. Is it possible? Do you think? I don't think so. But I think part of it is that, you know, Ron Paul's going after Santorum because Santorum's nuts. He says a lot of the dumbest stuff. Like he was on with George Stephanopoulos, and he was talking about the speech in 1960 that Kennedy gave to the Southern Baptist leaders, you know, basically saying, hey, you know what? I'm a Catholic, and no Catholic's ever been elected president, and, you know, people are out there saying things that aren't true. He's going, look, you know, the Pope is not going to call me on the bat phone and tell me what to do. I'm my own guy. There is definitely going to be there's a line between religion and government. And he says, you know, it should be absolute. He said, I believe in America where the separation of church and state is absolute. Well, Tricky Ricky said, I threw up when I read that, because he wants theocrats running the country. He wants his version of what religion is running this country. And immediately when I heard the I threw up comment, I immediately thought of James Madison. Because back in, well, I think 1811, I think, February 21st, I believe, my grandmother's birthday, 1811. No, she wasn't born in 1811. But he had issued one of his first vetoes. As president, he vetoed a bill that was introduced by the Episcopal and Baptist Church. And the purpose was is to get money for the church to carry out some, you know, some philanthropic things. They want to take care of poor children. They want to, you know, take care of, you know, what they're supposed to be doing anyway, what the radical right keeps telling us, what the churches should be doing. Well, they wanted government money to do it. And they wanted an infrastructure of government to do it. And Madison said no. He vetoes the bill basically because it would corrupt both, and because it's a violation of the Constitution. But, you know, our boy Tricky Ricky doesn't seem to think that way. You know, I wonder what the founders would really think of someone like him who is out there advocating for church and state to be one and the same. You know, I wonder about those 1960 voters who were really worried about the Catholic Church. What they would think of Santorum. Because don't you think that he is the embodiment of everything that they feared? I don't know. I mean, he just keeps, it's just crazier and crazier. And Mr. Family Values held a campaign event in Traverse City, Michigan. And they show the pictures of this dingy nightclub where one person from Yelp said, if you want to pick up an STD, this is the place. It's a place where they hold events like orgy and inked up tattoo ball. Also, they have sticky floors and flames on the walls. But again, the sketchiest club in Michigan, they say. And that's where he's going to hold his campaign event, talking about family values. I wonder if he would allow anyone who's taking contraception to come into the bar. And I guess you wonder why he's falling in the polls. You wonder why he's fallen in Michigan, where he should have walked away. Should have completely walked away. Like his statement the other day that Obama was wrong for apologizing for burning the Quran. He says, I don't think the president should have apologized for something that was clearly inadvertent. I think you apologize when you highlight it when you apologize for it to make it sound like something you should apologize for. There was no act needed for an apology. And I said, you know, what if someone accidentally burnt your book? Tricky. Would you be upset? I think you would. Anyway, today the Daytona 500 is going to run, rained out yesterday. But Tricky Ricky evidently is sponsoring Tony Raines, the number 26 car, in today's 500. I had some advice. He said, hang back and let the other cars in front of you get in wrecks. That was his advice. And or drop out of the race and then move up at the end, which is kind of how he's running this campaign. Kind of hung back, kind of didn't say very much, was kind of, you know, low key. And then after everybody beat each other up, he kind of moved up. But Mr. Raines is in the 21st row, starting at the back of the pack. So there you go. I love his critique of the car, though. Santorum had it. He said it was pretty spiffy. So there you go. Turns out, though, he wasn't the only one talking about NASCAR. Mitt Romney also had probably his dumbest comment of the weekend. He said, I don't follow as closely as some people do, but I have some friends who are NASCAR owners. So there you go. He has friends who own the NASCARs. What I find interesting is that Scarborough Research, they found in 2009 that 85% of people who call themselves NASCAR fans made less than $100,000 a year. 85%. And I would say that it's probably pretty high numbers of people making in the 50 and below range as well, like most people in this country. And I like the response that Democratic Party Communications Director Brad Woodhouse put out. He said, you know, I don't know people who fish, but I know people who own yachts, which is kind of the same mentality there. So again, another guy completely in touch. And he said, you know what? Romney said, if you can't relate to me, vote for the other guy. I suggest voting for the other guy anyway. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Locked out employees from American Crystal Sugar and Cooper Tire joined forces last week for a multi-state trip called Journey for Justice. The two companies had locked out employees for months after the employees voted down proposed contracts. While passing through Wisconsin, American Crystal Sugar worker Nathan Rand spoke with WIN executive producer Frank Emspach on our Madison-based radio program, The People's Mic, with Doug Cunningham.
What were the major issues that you were looking for in terms of a contract settlement? What was the union's position? What did you want to try to do?
Well, the biggest problem is they're basically trying to strip away all of our seniority rights. You know, as far as seniority for jobs, seniority for overtime, they want to eliminate all of that, be able to pick and choose who they want.
What does the seniority do for you? Because I think, again, a lot of people, particularly now, don't have contracts that have seniority. So people sometimes get hostile towards that. So what does seniority do for you in the workplace?
Well, the thing is that the biggest deal seniority matters for us is that, you know, you may have somebody that's a 30-year employee that knows our factory inside and out and everything. And you might have a kid that just started, and let's say he's the shift supervisor's nephew. Well, without seniority, they're more apt to give a job to somebody like that over a 30-year employee who already knows the place just because there's a favoritism because he knows somebody. It's not really a battle of us union members, you know. It's more or less keeping out favoritism and that kind of an aspect.
So you're saying that seniority is basically a way to ensure fairness.
Yes, fairness in the workplace, and the people that have been there and put in the most years should have the first shot at jobs. And the thing with our seniority is that they give you a 10-day trial, regardless of whether you've been there for 30 years or 3 years, and they give you a 10-day trial. If at the end of the 10-day trial the company says that you're not going to work out that job, they tell you that they don't want you in that position that you put a bid on, and they go down to the next person in line. The system has worked for us in the 4.5 years that I've been there, and they ultimately end up with the best, quote-unquote, person that they want. So it works just fine. Well, now they want to radically rewrite everything because they say that they need a plan for the future. And we had the most profitable year they've ever had last year. They praised us, patted us on the back, and we made billions of dollars for the company, and now all of a sudden they say that our contract that we've been working under is so horrible and they have to rewrite it.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Pull out a good old union as coming into clear. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast from the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. Also, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So last week we talked about this journey for justice from Fargo to Findlay, where the workers from American Crystal Sugar Company and Cooper Tire and Rubber started in Fargo, North Dakota, and made their way to Findlay, Ohio, highlighting the fact that a lot of these big corporations are now using our labor laws completely against working people, kicking them to the curb, locking them out, and without very little recourse. So when these folks started off on their journey, I was excited. I love seeing these kind of actions. I love, because it's an excellent time for education. That's why I've asked Teresa Brown. She's a United Steelworkers member from Cooper Tire and Rubber. She's also the Women of Steel coordinator for 207L. Teresa, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So were you on this journey for justice? Were you one of the folks who made it from Fargo to Findlay?
Yes, I was.
What made you jump into this? What made you want to make that journey?
Well, actually, my local union president and my sub-district director approached me about it, and I thought it sounded like a great deal because, you know, we need to get our message out across the country. Solidarity knows no boundaries, and our fight today may be your fight tomorrow.
Absolutely. And, you know, I look at this, and I've been on those kind of things, and it's the people that you meet along the way that make it so rewarding. So I'm curious, you know, who did you meet? What kind of stories did you come up with?
Well, when we started out the kickoff in Fargo, they had, I would say, anywhere from 400 to 500 members there, not just BCTGM, but U.S. United Steelworkers locals came for the rally. It was a very powerful rally. I, myself, and Becky got up and talked a little bit, you know, about our struggle, what was going on, and what we had hoped for during our journey. We left there, and every stop across the country, from Fargo to Findlay, we got a very overwhelming response, a welcome like you would not believe. They just were so into our stories and our fight and letting us know that they would back us. We exchanged business cards, email addresses. People are interested. You know, there was a lot of people that didn't know about American Crystals fight, you know, our fight, and we're getting the word out. And, you know, we've reached a tentative agreement last week with Cooper. We vote today on it. The voting is done right as of right now. And we can only think that maybe getting our word out put pressure on Cooper to get back to the table. And, you know, although that we don't, some of us don't feel that it's a fair contract, it forced them back to the table.
And that's
what we want Dave Berg to do for the American Crystal Sugar people. You know, get back to the table and get those people that have made your company profitable and get them a fair contract.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. You couldn't have said it better. I couldn't have said it better myself. But, you know, and I look at these kind of things, when you start shining lights on the people who are doing these underhanded tactics, when you start getting out and you start telling and people start paying attention, it does generally push them in the direction of, oh, I better do something, because this could mean business. Because as I said last week, no American Crystal Sugar in my household until this is done, and no Cooper Tires until this is done.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I know they would appreciate it too. We actually are getting back into Findlay right now, the four of us from Cooper, or Local 207, and the American Crystal Sugar workers are headed back to North Dakota. We had to readjust our journey because of the ratification, voting today.
Right.
And we ended up, the Ohio AFL had us down there for a luncheon and got to tell our story down there, both sides, to a lot of activists in Ohio. And then we visited a Nestle quality assurance factory that's in Dublin, Ohio. The lady that met them people, she was so into their story, had no idea that those people were locked out, that Nestle uses their sugar to make their product. She had no idea. They took pictures in there to show her, you know, what was going on and to bring awareness to them, because, you know, we all eat Nestle some way or drink it or something. And it's important to get the message out. You know, they're using scab sugar right now.
Yep.
And had no idea. She had no idea about it. And so, you know, although we got a TA out of possibly this journey, that we all felt great justice for her listening to them. You know, they went back and felt great about that.
Now, what I would like to see, I'd like to see our labor law changed so that we can start talking to those companies and say, you know what, we're you shouldn't be using that. We should have secondary boycotts where you say, stop buying this product as well, to put more pressure to force people back to the table.
Exactly.
You know, and I look at your situation, you know, with Cooper Tire and Rubber, and we talked with your local president not too long ago, and my rationale, and maybe you'll go with me, I'm not sure, but my rationale for the lockout is simply payback, because the steelworkers built that trade case that the U.S. government finally took to the WTO to hold the Chinese accountable and actually forced some jobs back to your area. And to me, it's retaliation.
Correct. I agree with that. You know, and our local was part of that. And, you know, Cooper wanted no part of that. And it's sad. You know, and you're right. It did force us to hire more people in there. And I do think that it's a retaliation thing. You know, this whole lockout totally caught us off guard. Chris Ostrander got hired at Cooper about 14 months ago approximately, has no ties to Cooper Tire, no ties to Findlay, Ohio. He's known throughout the country to go in and bust unions up and lock people out and shut plants down. And, we've always had a good relationship with Cooper, the union did, and always worked through our problems. And for them to do this to us, you know, it really woke us up and made us realize they are now part of corporate greed. You know, we basically are a number to them.
Yeah, that's a sad sad rationale and a sad thing to have to wake up to. But the reality is the right and the CEO class, they keep pushing this mean that labor and management unions and companies have to be adversarial and you have to be butting heads. When Most people I talk to are members of a union. They think of it as, we want our company to succeed, because if they do well, we're going to do well. And everyone does well together. They see it as, well, if the workers are doing better, maybe I can steal some from them so I can do even better still.
Exactly. You know, you always want your company to be profitable. I mean, it only makes sense. If they're not profitable, they're going to shut the place down, and then everybody's going to be without a job. You know, 3 years ago, they came to us during contract negotiations and had the plant foreclosure or the plant closure over our head. You know, we did the right thing, you know, helped them out and brought them out of, you know, trouble, gave up $30 million in concessions. We honestly thought that they were profitable over the last 3 years, substantially. And we really thought that they were going to do the right thing and, you know, reward us for it. You know, we're not asking for a pot of gold or anything, but just give us a little fair share of it.
And a little respect.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and I look at that. I remember talking to the folks from American Crystal Sugar saying, look, you know, before they threw us to the curb, they gave us a breakfast and T-shirts and said how wonderful we are and how they loved us and how we made the company and we were responsible for their best year ever. And the thanks that they got was not a pat on the back, not a pat on the back, but a boot in the behind.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? It's absolutely crazy. For us, you know, they it was a week of Thanksgiving on Monday and Tuesday. They came and said, we're going to give you extra days off for the holiday. On Wednesday, they had a TA reach. On Saturday, we had our informational meeting. On Sunday, we voted. On Monday, our members reported into work, and the first round of members had to report by 6 a.m. They were met instead at the parking lot with security guards telling us that Cooper Tire was going to extend our holiday to leave the property immediately. By 4:30 that day, they locked us out. You know, it's just totally asinine what they're doing. And all the money that they're spending on this, I'll try to be politically correct, these temporary replacement workers.
Scabs.
And all the security.
Scabs.
Exactly. All the scabs, all the scab security that they have around this place, you know, we could have been in there working. We could have had the same working relationship that we had in the past. But instead, they throw us out at Thanksgiving. They throw us out at Christmas, at New Year's. I mean, where's the just in that?
Again, it just highlights the broken status of our labor laws and the total complete disrespect that working people in this country get from big multinational corporations.
Exactly. And, you know, one thing that this lockout, I think we need to make sure that the public is aware of the difference between a lockout and a strike, because we get it all the time here in Findlay, and we got it when we went to the picket lines in Fargo. People driving by and telling us to get back to work and get a job. They need to be perfectly clear that Cooper Tire and American Crystal Sugar put us out. Yeah. We want to be in there working. And a lot of the public don't get that. You know, they did this to us. We want to be in there working.
Well, it sounds like from the horns in the background, it sounds like you're getting a lot of support. And I'm glad to hear that you guys have at least gotten people back to the table. I'm hoping the folks at American Crystal Sugar get back to the table and all of this gets resolved so that your families don't suffer anymore. Teresa Brown, I appreciate the time and thank you for your time.
You know, I'd like to say thank you to you too for putting us on the air and getting our message out. It means a lot to 1,050 lives in Findlay.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Teresa.
Yep, thank you.
Best to you. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
When you figure out, take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
During a recent city council meeting, the mayor of Keene, New Hampshire, leaned over to a council member and whispered excitedly, "We're going to have our own tank." Yes, the tank, or more specifically, the armored personnel vehicle, is the latest must-have play toy for mayors and police departments. Even in this picture-perfect and very tranquil New England town of only about 23,000 residents, officials get wide-eyed and hurl common sense aside at the very thought of having such a cool ride parked in front of Town Hall, and maybe even getting to drive it in the next 4th of July parade. Never mind that Keene has no crime that would warrant rolling out a tank. Nonetheless, thanks to such richly funded boondoggles as the War on Drugs and the War on Terrorism, the federal government is throwing money at cities and states to militarize their various police forces. Thus, Keene was granted $285,000 by the Department of Homeland Security to buy its very own Bearcat, an 8-ton combat vehicle. Of course, corporations that peddle such pricey hardware testily insist that Keene needs a tank. As a sales executive for Lenco Industries, which makes the Bearcat, snapped to an inquiring reporter, "I don't think there's any place in the country where you can say that is not a likely terrorist target. Wouldn't you rather be prepared?" The sensible people of Keene, however, are not swallowing the fearmonger pill, and they forced the town council to reconsider. Local businesswoman Dory O'Meara says she hasn't met a single person who's in favor of having this militaristic thing in Keene. She calls the tank completely unnecessary, but it's more than that, she adds. It's just not who we are. It's about what kind of town we want to be. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, wherever you live, take heart in the Keene example. Reject the corporate nonsense and insist on being the town you want to be. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You can email me or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So one of these shows on Fox Business, you know, some guy that I don't think I've ever seen him, but they were talking about the contract by the hotel cleaning folks in New York. So the cleaning maids who, look, they got a pretty decent contract. I would not be unhappy if I were them. But they, the business people, the Fox folks, nuts about it. Listen to this.
This is a financial program, so let's talk about money. How much do you think is, shall we say, a fair salary for a hotel maid in New York City? There's a new union proposal that would give housekeepers a raise to nearly $60,000 a year, plus medical coverage with no out-of-pocket expense to them and no doctor copay. That is the union demand.
That's what the union and the company sat down together and negotiated. It's not the union demand. That's what they negotiated. So that's telling me that the company's really profitable. And the workers should share in that. To me, I saw the $60,000 a year for a working class family. That is a fantastic, fantastic thing. Because you know if that hotel gets into trouble a couple of years down the line, they're going to come and say, well, you know, we need some of that back. But the righties, nuts about it. So they got this talking head woman on there who I have no idea who she is. But another, you know, just another one of these, well, just another kook. But listen to this. You'll
interesting how all of this sort of follows the whole DSK nightmare, but yeah. We're talking about 30,000 hotel maids across New York City, a 29% increase. This is a long-term contract,
yes,
a seven-year contract, not just medical, dental, optical, no out-of-pocket expenses. This is a nightmare.
It's a nightmare because the workers get a decent wage. They get health care. They get vision care. And you know what? It's of sufficient quality that to her, this is viewed as a nightmare. And I'm trying to figure out what the nightmare is. And to begin with, what's with the DSK thing? What's with the Strauss-Kahn comment? What has that got to do with these workers making a decent wage? Again, it's to try and belittle them, trying to demean these workers. Understand, cleaning hotel rooms, that's bust your behind kind of work. And to have people like this, I mean, it's kind of mind-blowing. So they brought this right-wing talking head in, another one, this is the talk radio guy. I don't know his name, don't care. He's pretty much an idiot. But here's his contribution to
the whole business model of a hotel room. Did you ever analyze the finances of a hotel room? They give you everything for free. Go in the bathroom, free shampoo, free sewing kit, free shoe polish, free toothbrush. Go in the minibar, touch one peanut, it's $50. How did that happen?
Panic buttons? You think that's the DSK effect?
It's such a gimmick. You know, a lot of workers, subway workers, and they face real danger. They just simply carry a walkie-talkie or something with them.
Yeah. The minibar. Don't know how it happened. Understand, the whole DSK thing, you know, happened last year. Touching the minibar has been a thing for a long time. Has nothing to do with the workers. But again, you've got to cloud the issue. And that's what they do. Everything is those people's fault. What I want to know is, as someone who works for a living, instead of looking at those people who bust their behind cleaning those rooms in really swanky, high-priced hotels, instead of saying, why should they get it? Why shouldn't they be miserable and make minimum wage like the rest of the people in the industry? Why don't we ask, why can't we all be raised up? But I guess we've been conditioned. I guess we've been trained to go to the lowest common denominator, to find the least in us. And I think that's where the bottom feeders, that's where conservatives, that's where they make their living. They're bottom feeders. And, you know, it's not surprising to me that they've been going after Obama over the price of gas. And it's like, look, you know, it would be like me taking responsibility for winning the Super Bowl or losing the Super Bowl. That's about as much control over the price of gas that Obama has. He could do a couple of things, maybe possibly release a little bit of the strategic reserve. It might send a shock, maybe just a little bit, but that'd be short-lived. So the righties have this great idea, and they have their great plan on how they would bring down energy prices. And I forget, someone emailed me this, and I forget what the guy's name is, but he has a 10-point plan. He's from Red State, one of these radical right-wing guys. His basic idea is, well, we've got to commit to a North American energy strategy, which means we need to drill, baby, drill. Let the Keystone XL go through, drill at Anwar, Nebraska, Montana, wherever. We need to drill, baby, drill. And, you know, okay, fine. You want to do that? Does what we drill, does it stay here? Oh, no. No, because his number two is we need to ditch the anti-industry, anti-capitalist rhetoric, because we need to be more business-friendly. Because when those oil companies make $137 billion in profit, according to this guy, they invest that into new wells. No, they invest that in giving themselves huge bonuses and paying the 1%. That's what they do. It has nothing to do with the nation. He says, stop targeting the oil industry for punitive tax treatment. You mean the 100 years of oil subsidies, the 100 years of handouts we've given to the oil industry? We should stop bringing that up? I'm sure the oil industry would like that. And I got to question the guy who wrote this and his positions on it. And I wonder who's funding him. He says that realize that Uncle Sam is in the energy business and isn't a partner. He's a partner with the industry. We need the industry to succeed because they're partners. He writes, oil and gas royalties are the federal government's number two source of revenue. Like somehow, stop and think about this. His argument is somehow government and corporations need to walk hand in hand. They need to make sure that industry succeeds because, after all that oil that we use, if big oil didn't make $173 billion, his idea is that wouldn't be the second highest revenue source. Seems kind of silly to me. But at the end of the day, I keep going back to, okay, I'm with you. Let's talk about drilling. Let's talk about all of these things that you want. Will we keep it domestic? And time again, they come back to, no. These are multinational corporations. These are not American companies. Understand that. Just because they're headquartered here, just because, as he points out, well, you know, the stocks are owned by the 1%. Those are American people who own those stocks. No, those are global citizens. Those are the very wealthy who don't care about this country or anywhere else, really. They care about profit. He goes on, his number five is recognize that industry does not need to be led by government. Industry needs to be unleashed. So in North Dakota and Pennsylvania and Texas, it's happened in spite of the federal government, not because of it. So I guess Pennsylvania is a shining crown jewel of the free enterprise system, where we've had the gut education benefits, funding for public school, funding for higher ed, funding for poor people, all that's cut and gut, yet we give tax breaks to the industry. That's what he's talking about, partnership. We need more of that, more partnership. And one of my favorite, my final favorite one is trust that no oil operator wants to be the next BP. And look, I don't think BP wanted to be BP with the spill. Understand, they wanted no part of that. But here's the reality. When you have an industry who's looking first and foremost and only at how much profit can I make, you are going to see corners being cut. When you have bonuses put out and paid for production, when you have bonuses paid out to hey, how much can you produce and how little time can you do it, how fast, you're going to have people who are willing to take shortcuts. We'll buy the cheaper, I forget what they call the thing, that was the regulator inside the well casting. Because that's what they claim went wrong. They bought a cheap one, it didn't work right, and boom, it blew. Why? Because it was cheaper. So when you have a situation like that, of course they don't want to be the next BP, but they're all setting themselves up because they're cutting corners. The incentive, understand how business works. I want to put more money in my pocket today. I don't want to think 20 years down the road. This is how American business works. It's quarter to quarter. CEOs get paid mostly by the stock price. So if this quarter I can make sure my stock price goes up, hey, I might be able to line my pockets. Understand this, though. No matter how much we drill, no matter how much we wreck, no matter how, if we push the Keystone Pipeline through, it's not going to budge the price of oil. It is an international commodity. If you're going to tell me, Rick, we're going to sell the oil here in the U.S. and it's not getting into the international market, I'm okay with it. But increasing the amount of supply so that everyone else, China and India and the rest of the world, can enjoy a little bit lower price, a penny or two, just doesn't seem to be the smart way to go. I'm going to wreck my environment so that they can pay a penny less too? No. Let's take that money. Let's take that initiative. Let's take those ideas and move away from oil. Whatever it is. I'm a big fan of solar. I'm a big fan of wind, geothermal, you name it. We should be whole full speed ahead. But we don't have the political will because the moneyed interest. Understand. The big five, they profited $137 billion last year. You don't think they just sit that money in a bank account somewhere, do you? They use that money for heavy lobbying. And they spend a little bit of it, a little bit of it. I'm not even going to say a good portion. They spend a little bit of it, which is still a lot of money, on influencing policy, on influencing our politics. Which is why it's not surprising to me that, you know, as soon as Occupy Atlanta has their occupation of the AT&T building, that a week later you see a bill that would criminalize that activity, not only just criminalize it, but make it a felony in a state where three felonies get you locked up forever. So I'm going to sit down three times and that's going to make me, it's going to put me in forever right next to the guy who committed double homicide? And the answer is yes, because to the wealth class, your standing up and fighting back is just as bad as double homicide. Because how dare you step out of line? How dare you think that you have something to say? No surprises here. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the hell
with. Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show. Earth, Sky.
Monday, February 27th. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, you can see all five visible planets sometime between sundown and late evening tonight and for the next several weeks.
South of the equator, you can see four planets. The exception is the most elusive planet, Mercury. In their outward order from the Sun, the visible planets are Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
Start looking for the planets as soon as darkness falls. Look westward first, the direction of sunset. Tonight you'll find the waxing crescent moon above the brilliant planets Jupiter and Venus. When it's dark enough, draw a line downward through the moon, Jupiter, and Venus to locate Mercury near the sunset point on the western horizon.
Now turn to the opposite side of the sky, the east, at nightfall. Mars lurks low in the east when the sun goes down. It's about at its best now for this two-year period, very bright and reddish. You might be able to pick it out just by looking for the brightest, reddest object in the east at nightfall.
The fifth planet, Saturn, is up in the east by about midnight, as seen from around the globe. Saturn shines close to a bright star now, Spica and the constellation Virgo. Saturn looks golden, while Spica sparkles blue-white.
We have sky charts at the Tonight page of EarthSky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I thought Mitt Romney couldn't say anything dumber than this.
Little history. I was born and raised here. I love this state. It seems right here. Trees are the right height.
Trees are the right height. He comes out with, well...
That's just the way it is. If people think there's something wrong with being successful in America, then they better vote for the other guy.
Better vote for the other guy. And I suggest maybe you just go ahead and vote for the other guy anyway. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you very much.
I see that that the president has finally taken to the snobbery comment, which I've been waiting for some time. Since Santorum said it, I got to think it was early January when he said this.
As I was saying earlier today, the President of the United States came out and said, under my administration, every child should go to college. What elitist snobbery out of this man?
You know what's frightening to me?
Yeah.
There are people applauding that.
Yeah.
What the President had to say.
The president spoke to the National Governors Association today to pitch education and investment, and he said, I have to make a point here. When I speak about higher education, we're not just talking about a four-year degree. We're talking about somebody going to a community college and getting trained for that manufacturing job that now is requiring somebody walking through the door handling a $1 million piece of equipment. And they can't go in there unless they've got some basic training beyond what they received in high school.
And what kind of response did he get?
He got a pretty good response. I mean, he got a pretty good response. And in the press availability later on in the afternoon, there were Republican governors, Governor Bob McDonnell of Virginia, Chris Christie of New Jersey, for example, who were speaking up for the president's policies on education.
Wow. You know, maybe they read the Wall Street Journal today, where the folks at the shills for the American Enterprise Institute came out and said, well, you know, if we just had educated workers, there'd be at least 600,000 more manufacturing jobs, because these big companies, they just can't find workers, so they can't come back. My synopsis. My synopsis of the piece, which is, you know, to me, I remember, and I'm not that old, you used to start off at an entry-level job, and they trained you. According to the article, those days are long gone. It takes too long. We need just-in-time employees.
Yes.
Snobbish. I'm just amazed. So I guess the pipeline is going to begin being constructed. Is that true?
Well, yes, a sort of standalone bit. Actually, it's a major portion of it. It's a piece that runs from Cushing, Oklahoma, to refineries on the Gulf Coast. It's being called the Gulf Coast Project. It's going to cost $2.3 billion, be completed mid to late 2013. It's still got to receive some more regulatory approvals. And separately, TransCanada says it will reapply in the near future for the permit that will allow the Keystone XL to cross from Alberta, Canada, into the United States. Now, the Oklahoma to Texas portion would carry crude oil pumped from land in the Midwest and surrounding areas to refineries in Texas. It would not carry Canadian oil sands.
Okay.
And the White House said today that it supports TransCanada's bid to build the Oklahoma to Texas portion, says the project will help address the bottleneck of oil in Cushing that's resulted in large part from increased domestic oil production, currently at an eight-year high.
Now, how much of that oil that we're shipping from Oklahoma to Texas will stay in the United States?
Well, that, I have no idea, but, I mean, that's not how the oil business works.
Well, we're building pipelines, and they keep telling me on the right, and I keep hearing the Republicans telling me we need an energy strategy, and we need to drill, baby, drill, but how is that going to help me at the pump?
Well, this is it. You see, I don't know the answer to this question because I don't see it as a simple that if you drill it or if you build a pipeline that is necessarily going to help you at the pump tomorrow. I don't think this is going to help.
And it's not. And that's why I think they're being disingenuous. And I should say that's why I think they're lying.
Yes.
Not going that far with me, are you?
I am just reporting here.
There you go. The Supreme Court, another decision today?
Supreme Court decision. No, this is not a Supreme Court decision. This is the House taking aim at a Supreme Court decision.
Oh, okay.
The House today is likely to vote on legislation that will overturn a 2005 Supreme Court decision. That was a decision that held that state and local governments can take private property under the principle of eminent domain in order to further their economic development plans.
Okay. Now, the Connecticut case.
The Connecticut case, exactly.
And what are they doing on it?
What they're doing is they've got the Private Property Rights Protection Act, which I think Jim Sensenbrenner is behind. And it came out of the House Judiciary Committee 23-5, and it will prevent states from using eminent domain over property to be used for economic development and establish a private right of action for property owners if a state or local government violates the new rule.
Interesting. Well, I'm actually in favor of that.
I think they feel that the Supreme Court overreached because they upheld the right of New London, Connecticut to take non-blighted land and transfer it to a private developer in a bid to increase local tax revenue. And that wasn't basically what the idea was in the first place.
Yeah, and after that, you find out all across the country they've been using it for the same thing and just doing it for pretty much the same, not what they did in up in London, but what they've done in a number of other places. They've given it to business interests because what's good for business?
Well, this is good for business.
Yeah, well, we shall see. And lastly, I see you have something on some researchers pretty much telling me what we already knew, another one of these studies that
I think we knew. I thought you'd like this. This is the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences report out today. They did 7 different experiments, and it proves, they say, the rich really are different. They said the upper class, as defined by the study, were more likely to break the law while driving, take candy from children, lie in negotiations, cheat to increase their odds of winning a prize, and endorse unethical behavior at work. Taken together, the experiment suggests at least some wealthier people perceive greed as positive and beneficial, possibly as a result of education, personal independence, and the resources they have to deal with potentially negative consequences.
Yep. Well, taking candy from children, that doesn't surprise me. Look at that governor they got up in Maine. He bragged about it.
Really?
Yeah. LePage, I think his name is. Yeah.
Yes, I think that is his name,
yeah.
Yes.
He bragged about it right after he was elected. Yes, when I used to wait for the kids at Halloween, I'd beat them up and take their candy.
What?
I was bigger and I was better.
What?
Yeah, well, you know, hey, what do you expect from a bully? And none of this is surprising to me because you look at how they treat foreclosures. You look at how Romney's position on foreclosures. Let those poor people lose their houses so I can come in, buy it up cheap, and then I'll rent it back to them. I mean, that's the mentality. These folks have different emotional attachments. I have a very wealthy uncle, and how different his kids are to me. His kids don't believe in showing up on time or work ethic. It's all about how can I use somebody else to get to my means. That's where I'm one of these people. You get there early, you stay late, you bust your behind, and, well, I guess we're in two different worlds.
Yes, it looks like it. That is what it's increasingly looking like.
And, you know, I've got three kids, and I often wonder, my wife and I talk about this, you know, should I not teach them to be lying, thieving little cheats who our society has said those are the people who get ahead?
I think you should teach them to not be lying, cheating little things.
Yes, well,
yes. I think that's what you should do.
And we're not, but, you know, my point is every time I see one of these big corporations or one of these wealthy people get caught doing something that everybody says they shouldn't be, what do they get? Barely a slap on the wrist. Michael Milken is one of those guys that, a name you probably haven't heard for a while, one of those guys that you go, okay, you spent 18 months in jail, but how much money did you pocket? How much did he hide? It's just, well.
Yes.
Angering. Victoria Jones,
yes.
Always, always, always inspiring.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey Planing Mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy.
with the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, you can get our podcast there at the website. Or if you have a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So this morning, just about a half an hour south of, or half an hour east of my hometown of Cleveland, another one of these school shootings, one student killed and four others injured. They say they have the gunman. Early reports were there were two gunmen. I think right now they're just saying now just one. But our thoughts and our best wishes to the other four and their families go out. You know, I look at this stuff and you go, what kind of a crazy situation is this? I mean, Chardon is a decent school district. It's a decent place. I mean, you know, to see this kind of stuff is just, it's maddening. Anyway, a federal judge in Montana has blocked more of Montana's election rules. Again, you know, this whole Citizens United thing has really got everything mucked up. As you look at Montana, who's really trying to say, you know what, we want to put some restrictions on what's being spent. We want to hold back corporations a little bit because I don't believe they're people either. And maybe put some rules in place where people have to tell the truth. It's one of those things that I've said the Democrats should really focus on. While the Republicans are pushing for this suppression bill, where's your voter ID? Where are your papers? While they're pushing for that, Democrats should be pushing equally for, you want to go that route? How about we make a law that everything you put out has to be honest? That has to be true. You know, maybe a little truth in advertising, instead of knowingly making false statements. And they're saying that, you know, this judge's decision, has struck down the state's ban on knowingly false statements, in political, election material. He's also struck down the ban on, preventing misrepresentations of a state candidate's, record. And also blocked a requirement that political attacks disclose relevant voting records. So you know, you look at this and you go, okay, well, if what we see is nonsense, and we're not going to hold anybody accountable, at least you know hold back how much of it we see. Maybe they're going to have a full hearing, a full trial to decide what the limits are, because, you know, they tried to put some limits on how much money you can donate, to a candidate. And Citizens United pretty much blew the cap off all of that and said, you know, too bad. They're gonna be able to spend as much as they want. Now, the attorney general there in, Montana, a guy named Steve Bullock, he says he's pleased that the order did preserve two aspects of Montana's campaign finance law. Contributing limits and the prohibition on direct corporate contributions to campaigns. So, you know, that's something. And, you know, he says, look, you know, he looks forward to showing at trial how the laws of Montana governing true campaigning are something that are needed and what their purpose is. Personally, I'm in favor of, you know, you got to have these, if you're going to make accusations and you're going to run negative ads, at least they should be true. And not, you know, depends on how you interpret it. No, it's got to be true. Which I think if you put some type of a requirement on that, you would hear people talking about what I would do, how I would run things, and what my record is, instead of saying, that guy's a no good SOB. Well, why vote for you? Okay, I take it. He's no good. Why you? And that's the thing that's always blown my mind with this negative campaigning. All right, I get it. I don't like the guy. He's not done well. But why you over him? Why somebody else over him? Not getting it. Just not getting it whatsoever. And money really is corrosive to our system. It's absolutely destroying our political process. Look at how divisive it's gotten. And you know why? Well, because the billionaire class has figured out from the beginning of time that they can divide us. They know. They can pit us against each other. And they have. And over what? Really, some kind of dumb stuff. I mean, the fact that, and I think Romney zinged Santorum over this. I guess Santorum had written an op-ed or something saying we need to talk about the economy, and Romney's like, well, it's about time. You've been talking about nothing but these insane social issues that only a small percentage of lunatics really care about. Most people want to know, how am I going to feed my kids? How am I going to support my family? How am I going to save for the future? How am I going to pay their rising tuition bills to college? How am I going to put up with the rising tax bills for my local property because the governor here in Pennsylvania has walked away from education? How's that going to happen? And they don't have answers. I mean, that's the amazing part of all this. There are no answers from the Republicans. All it is the same failed policy, the same stuff that got us into this mess. And I've asked time and time again, show me where their policies have benefited me. How have they benefited my family? How have they benefited the country? Well, all I see is their policies making that the wealth class wealthier. You know, since Reagan took office, you know, the sainted Reagan, look at the path of inequality. Look at the gulf between those who have and those who don't. Look at the jobs that we have here. And Bloomberg News did an interesting piece today that I'm going to talk about tomorrow for sure. You're not going to want to miss this. But you know, they're talking about the jobs that Romney so-called created. And I'm like, well, it's about time someone picked this up. You know, Staples jobs, Sports Authority, well, you know, hey, they're jobs. They're like minimum wage jobs, though. And in fact, the one survey group, this Glassdoor.com, said the average job is less than $9 an hour with no benefits. So, hey, they're jobs, okay, but are these the jobs we wanted? Is this the direction we want the country to go? And I say this just isn't Romney's creation. This is Reagan's creation. You know, I was old enough back during the Reagan years to pay attention and to remember the rhetoric. We were a strong manufacturing country. We built lots of stuff. And through his high dollar policy and his ideology of we're just going to be business friendly and let them go wherever they want, and we'll build a service-based economy, we'll push papers around, and we'll take that manufacturing overseas. And we'll be a service-based economy, and everything will be wonderful. That's what started us down this path. Because the big titans of industry, that's what they wanted. And now we've given it to them, and look where we are. All because, well, he was a great communicator. He delivered a good line. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall! And you go, well, how much did he have to do with it? Well, some. I would say the labor movement here in the U.S. probably had as much to do with it as he did by funding the Solidarity movement in Poland. But you don't hear that too much in history books. You hear Reagan gave the speech. Reagan, that the speech made him feel bad. That and the fact that we basically emptied out the Social Security Trust Fund to throw at military defense contractors. That helped speed their demise, but they were crashing no matter what. They couldn't keep up. They couldn't pay for guns and oil butter, by the way. Because their people were saying, no more. We want what we're seeing. We want a better life. We want to be able to get toilet paper. And I've heard that thrown out a bunch of times. I've talked to a bunch of people who lived there during that period. There were no four-hour lines for toilet paper. But you did have only one or two or three choices. Not like here. So they were coming down no matter what, and everybody knew it. Yeah, I remember reading a book, and I can't remember who the general was, but this was back in the early 90s. And his premise was Russia was never going to be our big problem. China and India, those are going to be our problems because they're massive populations of people who are at the bottom of the scale, the desperate, and those are the people you got to look out for. He foresaw, you know, everything that happened, you know, it, pretty much what's going on right now. So I look at this piece over at Bloomberg, and it's worth taking a look at, where they talk about, look, the reality is if you can get into management at one of those places, you'll be all right. They usually pay you a decent wage. It usually has, you know, some benefits of some sort. But for the most part, if you work on the line or you work at the cashier's booth or whatever, you're going to live in poverty. Because the poverty line for a family of three, $19,090, if you work 40 hours a week at less than $9, you don't make it. And these are the kind of jobs that are being created. These are the fast-growing jobs, the low-paid ones. So the question is, you know, are that the direction we want the country to go with him claiming to be the job creator? Are these the jobs that we want created? And I would argue no. I would argue the jobs I think we want are the jobs that pay a decent living wage where we have opportunity. And I would even say that those jobs, the Sports Authority and the Staples job, could be decent family-sustaining jobs. You know, I go back to my grandmother who, you know, worked at a small department store in Cleveland, made a pretty good wage for a clerk. You know, she was a cashier there for 22 years. When she retired in 1985, she's making $8 an hour. $8 an hour, that was that, 27 years ago? They're barely making that now. But she had full health care, full vision, full dental, vacation, sick time. They don't have that anymore. And I listened to this woman from this Fox Business thing, and it just blows my mind.
Interesting how all of this sort of follows the whole DSK nightmare, but we're talking about 30,000 hotel maids across New York
30,
City. 000. A 29% increase. This is a long-term contract.
Yes,
a seven-year contract.
Yes.
Not just medical, dental, optical, no out-of-pocket expenses. This is a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. Is that the America you want to live in, where workers get paid and they have health care and they have vision? Is that the America? That's a nightmare. Well, I wouldn't want to live in a country like that. Would you? Well, yeah, I would. In fact, I'd like to go back I'd like to return to the good days where workers got health care and had a pension and had a little job security and had a say on the job. And it's only going to happen if you and me and everybody who works for a living stands together, takes to the streets, and fights back, like the folks in Georgia, like the folks in Michigan. That's what's got to happen, folks. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, you might want to go back and listen to the interviews with our friend from Georgia and from Michigan to find out what they're doing there. You can always go to the ricksmithshow.com and download our podcast. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally, and sometimes I use them here on the air. Have a great night. We will see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com.